Thanks to everyone for being here. Nice crowd on a nice warm, I guess it's still spring day. This is technically, I guess, a meeting of the Minnesota Legislative Energy Commission, although obviously it goes a little bit beyond that with the presenter that we have today and the crowd that it has attracted. Being that this is a legislative function and we had positive responses from more than 30 legislators, 10 or 12 of whom are already here, we thought rather than just start with the main attraction, which is, of course, Dr. Martinson, we would let Dick Hemmingson from the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment at the University of Minnesota sort of warm up the crowd by giving us a brief overview of what has been happening with this, I think, really vital research entity at the university. So with that, I would call on Mr. Dick Hemmingson. Dick, I believe your title is the Executive Director of the initiative. And I would point out that there is still plenty of seating down front. This is not, we're not going to sing hymns or anything. It's okay to come down front. And we'll let a couple more people get seated. And Dick, I turn it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative Hilty, Senator Bretner-Solon, for the opportunity to provide a brief overview of some of the activities of the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment. And I can tell you it's a significant challenge, although fortunately my rigorous academic training will hold up, hopefully. I'll have you know, Representative Hilty, I was the salutatorian of my sixth grade class in Redwood County Rural School District number 71. My sixth grade class consisted of two pupils, and Sharon Thorsten was smarter than me. She was the valedictorian. So at any rate, it is indeed a pleasure, and I'm going to fairly quickly just sort of a 40,000-foot look, if you will, of this initiative at the University of Minnesota that actually began formally in 2003 when actually several members of the legislative body in this room helped create the funding source to launch this initiative around this mission statement, which is the one that we created before we had a name, before we had funding, which still drives our work today, to promote statewide economic development, sustainable, healthy, and diverse ecosystems, and national energy security by developing bio-based and other renewable resources and processes. And as I always point out, internally and externally, the commas and the semicolons and the ands in that mission statement are all important. It's not only about production of energy. It's not solely about, you know, sustainable, healthy, and diverse ecosystems. It's all of the above, all of the time. And as I mentioned, the legislature has been instrumental in providing the support for this program at the university with the initial legislation back in 2003, and then again in 2007 when essentially the authorization was re-upped and the funding level from the XL Energy Renewable Development stands currently at $5 million a year. This is a visual that describes relatively accurately the balance within our portfolio at the University of Minnesota. As you might expect, a significant emphasis on bioenergy, biopower, and bioproducts. A very strong and historically strong and growing program in solar research at the University of Minnesota. Less work, but more recently significant work, both in wind and hydro and geothermal, which I'll touch on and by way of example, and something that I think we all would agree on that we need to spend more time on, and what I sometimes refer to as the other side of the equation, that is conservation and efficient energy utilization. From the outset, something unique to this program at your University of Minnesota has been this, you know, undergirding or cross-cutting area of effort that we refer to as policy, economics, and ecosystems. And we think it's critical that the research in some new, and here comes a highly technical term, doodad for converting bioenergy to a next generation biofuel, for example, that we concurrently take into consideration the issues of policy, economics for obvious reasons, and the environmental costs or benefits of these new systems. We have identified within this broader portfolio some areas for sharper focus. We're currently not reevaluating, but evaluating which of these should be continued, which should be added. And, of course, we need to pay significant attention to the efforts on curriculum, education development, and our role at the University of Minnesota in workforce development and training the next generation of scientists. One of the advantages of an institution such as the University of Minnesota for an initiative as comprehensive as this is the array of disciplines that are available at the University of Minnesota, but more importantly, necessary to address these so-called sticky wicket problems of it significantly advancing sustainable next-generation renewable energy systems. And we're fortunate to have many of those required disciplines all on board at an institution such as ours. So let me just share with you a few brief examples of some of our work, starting out with some work related to bioenergy and bioproducts, and I think for obvious reasons, a map that I'm sure all of you have seen before, the NREL map showing the concentration of biomass resources here in this part of the country in which we live. So it obviously is important that we take advantage of those resources as we think about our next generation energy systems. So I use this example not just as it relates to bio-related projects, but across our portfolio that is critically important in our judgment to focus on systems. So looking at the bio-based Lego set, if you will, looking not only at the next generation feedstocks that are going to be needed or available, but also the, if you will, the next generation conversion systems. How do we convert those existing crops, energy crops, new crops, residues, etc., to something useful, either via biological or thermochemical means, or more likely, as many of us believe, these integrated systems where you'll see some of each in efficient conversion systems, and also need to pay attention to what are the end products, be they fuels, be they products, etc. And we really work hard to ensure that while an individual research team may not span that entire system, that they're cognizant of where their efforts fit into the renewable energy system. And again, as I mentioned, doing this also against the backdrop of policy, economics, and ecosystems. So a few examples then that have come out of these efforts at the University of Minnesota. One is this concept that David Tillman and several of his colleagues here at the University of Minnesota developed, the concept of carbon negative biofuels. That is, biofuels that aren't just carbon neutral, but in fact, in this case, prairie-based systems, perennials, have the prospect at least of being carbon negative because of the inputs for that crop and, more importantly, what's going on in these perennial root systems under the soil in terms of capturing and sequestering carbon. So that's a terminology that emanated now in the national landscape from work here at the University of Minnesota funded by IRE. We spent a lot of time in the conversion arena, both biologically and thermochemically, focusing on smaller-scale distributed conversion systems. And so here you see a myriad or collage of photographs of a few of the faculty working in that, from Professor Roger Ruan on the left to Lanny Schmidt and Michael Sapatsis over on the Department of Chemical Engineering and Material Sciences. Again, several projects looking at smaller scale distributed conversion systems, which we think are going to be critically important in the context of next generation bio-based renewable energy systems. Another aspect of that, especially on the biological side, is much of the focus on so-called cellulosic fuels. has been focused on, as the name infers, can you capture the sugars from the cellulose or the hemicellulose portion of the feedstock? And in fact, especially for woody biomass, which we have a significant supply of in this part of the country, how to get at the sugars, the energy content of the lignin. So we have some significant work on, you know, breaking down lignin and getting at those. And so some of this work is part of one of the big DOE biofuels national centers in conjunction with the DOE's Oak Ridge National Lab. And more recently, one of our younger faculty working on this project received a very prestigious and highly competitive National Science Foundation Early Career Award based on this work. Another area of emphasis, a few examples here, is our current effort in looking at algal-based renewable energy systems, in this case working in cooperation and partnership with the Metropolitan Wastewater Treatment Facility and the Metropolitan Council to look at the role that algae might play not only in helping to remove phosphorus and nitrogen from the waste stream, but also can we have those algae be higher oil content algae that we might convert, for example, to diesel fuel or other higher valued products. So that's an example of some of our work. We have a very strong program kind of at the back end of this system and on next generation engines and fuel utilization systems, a picture here of David Kittleson, in what is still called the Center for Diesel Research, but more properly ought to be named the Center for Alternative Fuels Research because it spans the spectrum. And at the much smaller scale, Daniel Bond looking at what I refer to as his generator in a jug concept, small scale miniature microbial based fuel cells, looking at the genetics of the algal systems. One of the three major collections of the genomes of this species of algae are housed on the St. Paul campus right across the street from where the IRE office is. And something that is easily, I think, and sometimes often overlooked, the prospect for renewable plastics, polymers, etc., from bio-based materials. So here's a picture of Mark Hillmeyer. He and several of his colleagues, Mark from the Department of Chemistry, but a large group of people across the university looking at sustainable polymers utilizing bio-based materials. And the website for the Center for Sustainable Polymers is listed there. So those are a few of the examples at the more technical end. We've also, in the last couple of years, worked on a couple of biofuels feasibility studies that the legislature authorized a couple years ago, in one case with the White Earth Indian Reservation in northwestern Minnesota, and in the other case, a group of counties, Chisago, Isani, Pine County, on biofuels feasibility. So a few examples in the bioenergy front. Solar is an interesting opportunity, and I think it is, in my judgment, a underappreciated and certainly underutilized resource. So here is NREL's solar map. Notice the two ovals where we are here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and the corollary colors on the map take us down to Jacksonville, Florida, in terms of the strength of our solar resource here. So it is not as good as Arizona, to be clear, but it's pretty significant, something that we should take advantage of. And so we have a number of programs in the solar space, a few examples, looking at next-generation materials for high-efficiency, low-cost solar cells, in this case, obviously, PV or photovoltaic solar cells. One of our newer projects that was just started a year ago is looking at developing in the solar cell such that it takes advantage of the full bandwidth of the solar sunlight falling on that cell so that individual cells within that solar cell take advantage of the various bandwidths with the hope, at least, and frankly the expectation that these will lead to significantly more efficient solar PV cells. Inkjet direct write solar cells and a whole group of these are the thin film solar cells efforts that we're working on, and also a lot of effort that I don't have a slide on looking at organic materials for organic photovoltaic cells are some of the efforts. On the solar thermal front, a number of efforts. This is a photograph of Dr. Jane Davidson in the Department of Mechanical Engineering on a significant project funded earlier on in IRE's history, looking at particularly at solar hot water heating opportunities in terms of the materials, both in the collector and in the transport materials, and working in this case with Pulte Homes, as you know, a major builder of homes, in terms of redesigning the roof structure to accommodate these next-generation solar facilities. This is a really exciting project that is just now completing its first year of effort. A really interesting, it is in fact a high risk, but if it's successful, a high return endeavor. Martin Saar and his colleagues in the Department of Geology, looking at essentially, if you will, a combination of geological carbon sequestration, but not just that, taking advantage of the heat transfer capacities of the carbon dioxide and the heat and the deeper geological structures to essentially put, if you will, cool or relatively cool CO2 down into the geological structure and allow the heat transfer to warm that CO2 back up and then extract it through a Rankine cycle or some similar engine to, in fact, regenerate some electricity as a result of that captured heat. This is a project that just recently received a supplemental $1.5 million award from the Department of Energy to advance this work. So that's an exciting opportunity. In the case of wind research, I wanted to call your attention to a fairly recent award that the University of Minnesota faculty got from the Department of Energy. You can read the name as well as I, but it was one of three awards nationally made by the Department of Energy to significantly advance wind research. One of the unique attributes of this proposal is you can see the list of partners and the list of collaborators within the university that came together to develop this proposal. I should mention the reason that the industrial partners in the blue shaded area are in blue is the proposal went in and the request for proposals from the DOE indicated it would be a $12 million award. Two of them nationally. They ended up funding three at $8 million. So for the moment, the parts of the program that are shaded in blue are currently not part of the proposal, but a lot of discussions underway with DOE to, if you will, make this program whole. And it's addressing, you know, some of the critical issues that many of you, all of you, I'm sure, are familiar with in terms of next generation large wind technology. We are just wrapping up another project in collaboration with Xcel Energy on a wind-to-battery storage project out at Luverne, looking at, depending on your terminology, relatively large storage, not large in the context of what's going to be needed ultimately, but to look at storage of wind electricity. And many of you are perhaps aware of some of our efforts out at Morris at the West Central Research and Outreach Center, started out as and continues as a wind to hydrogen project, but more recently, in fact, under or about to be finally, Representative Westrom, under construction as we speak, is the wind to hydrogen to anhydrous ammonia part of that project, which would be a really interesting application of renewable electrons, if you will, to provide a badly needed source of renewable nitrogen fertilizer for the state's corn crop. So those are some examples of wind, and also out at the West Central Research and Outreach Center, we are trying to establish that as a site for significant evaluation, validation, and demonstration of smaller scale renewable energy systems at that site. We spend a lot of effort, as I mentioned, in the so-called policy, economics, and ecosystems cluster. One example of our work there is looking not only at the emissions from conventional and renewable fuel systems, how much they are, but where they are, in quantifying those issues. So that is a really an advanced life cycle analysis program currently underway. So just a few slides to conclude this brief overview. I can assure you there is no shortage of ideas for research at the University of Minnesota. We conduct an internal call for proposals to review and select projects. So just within the last several months, with our so-called large grant solicitation, these are large in the context of the amount of funding and the size of the teams and the length of the project. But as you can see, we had a significant number of proposals, 25 from some 100 investigators. And if we'd had the funding to the tune of about $15 or $16 million, we could have funded them all. We ended up selecting in the most recent round nine proposals. We started a new program this year focused on early career faculty, designed to attract faculty newer to the University of Minnesota to focus some significant parts of their work on renewable energy, and that was a fairly successful response, and we selected, as you can see, six of those proposals, and also our seed grant program was also highly competitive. And these awards that are on this screen are just going to be starting now with the start of the new fiscal year. We also have what we call a special opportunity. We had focused some recent efforts on this algae program I mentioned earlier in the last year. We worked in collaboration with the Minnesota corn growers recently on some next generation research proposals in partnership with their checkoff funds to advance some areas there. And these are some areas that we're contemplating looking at to a focus in the coming year. And then we also maintain our matching grant program. And as of just last week, we have about 2 million of these IRE resources pledged on grants that were awarded by the external funding agency that leveraged about 14 million in external funds. And currently pending is about another, I see that my commas are indeed not in the right place. I apologize. 1.5 million that is supposed to be roughly of IRE resources that if all of these external awards are made, will bring in an additional $28 million in leverage funds. Now, we're not so bold as to expect that they'll all be funded, but we expect a number of them to be. So finally, let me just conclude with what I think is really an important and I would say critical need for substantial and sustained investment in public research at the university by just sharing with you a couple of other examples. In the first case, this is a picture of Dr. Ed Fletcher in his concentrated solar collector on the roof of the mechanical engineering building on the Twin Cities campus circa 1970. And, you know, as is oftentimes the case, the funding comes and funding goes and the ability to sustain those efforts. But this work was started really in many respects, I think accurately described as the grandfather or godfather of concentrated solar energy research. Fast forward to more recently in IRE's history, Professor Gene Davidson initially back in 2005 looked at concentrating solar as a means to produce hydrogen from a water-splitting zinc oxide cycle. More recently, that work has advanced to looking at concentrating solar as the energy source for biomass gasification. As you may or may not know, normal thermochemical conversion processes for biomass consume roughly about 40% of the energy in the biomass in the process. If you can supply that energy from a concentrated solar source, you get essentially, as I used to say when I grew up on the farm, all of the squeal out of the pig in terms of all of the energy content in that biomass. And more recently, using concentrated solar to recycle carbon dioxide to fuels, and this is currently part of a proposal into, not yet awarded or not awarded, of what I call reverse combustion. And so this is in partnership with Sandia Laboratories in Arizona State on using, again, concentrated solar to take atmospheric CO2 and convert them back into hydrocarbon-based fuels. So that's one story. And this work started, as you can see, back in the 70s and was needed to continue to sustain the effort. Let me close with just one other example. This is a picture of the Larry Wackett Research Group at the University of Minnesota. And here in a nutshell, the story is this. Back in the early formative days of IRE, one of the very first sets of projects that we funded was a project that some of you may recall touring in the past, the so-called artificial leaf process, where Mike Flickinger, unfortunately no longer with the university, developed this latex paint-like film structure to embed photosynthetic organisms, and when exposed to sunlight, they produced hydrogen. That work has proceeded, and ultimately, let me back up. At the same time, Larry Wackett proposed to IRE, and we funded the idea that Larry's work was largely on microorganisms, what they do, what they can consume in the course of their metabolic activity, or the products that they can excrete as a result of that metabolic activity. So Larry, for example, was spending a lot of time on bioremediation, specifically of atrazine spills. So he reasoned there must be microorganisms that could produce long hydrocarbon chains similar, if not identical, to those that come into a petrochemical refinery. He started with unorganisms, switched to the Shewanella organism, and in fact, at the lab level, determined that was indeed possible. In the meantime, this artificial leaf concept spun off into a local startup company called BioC. And fast forward to just a year ago when a new funding agency within the Department of Energy called ARPA-E, Advanced Renewable something-something, patterned after DARPA-E in the defense industry, put out a call for proposals. 3,700 concept papers from across the country were funded or were submitted. 360 of those were called back to submit a full proposal, and 37 were funded, one of them this project. Again, based on that early work with now the BioC technology on the photosynthetic film, embedding these bacterial organisms along with blue-green algae, which are photosynthetic organisms, in this thin-film photobioreactor. So in a nutshell, the blue-green algae convert, just like the leaves on your tree do, the atmospheric CO2 to plant sugars. The bacteria in that film convert them to longer carbon chains, and the folks over, Lanny Schmidt and his colleagues over in chemical engineering, convert them to petroleum-like fuels. Over the edge, perhaps, far-reaching, to be sure, but if successful, pretty dramatic, and as I said, this is one of the 37 projects that RPE funded. So just a couple slides then to conclude. One of the things we worry about and think about on a constant basis is this continuum, if you will, from the fundamental basic science all the way over to, if you will, steel in the ground, a commercial application. And sometimes, perhaps too often, it's the case that places like where I work at the University of Minnesota are focused over on the left-hand side of the continuum, and the needs and opportunities of business and industry are focused over on the right-hand side of the continuum. And one of our many goals is to develop these partnerships and collaborations to, if you will, shorten the handoff between the more fundamental basic science and the more applied science and the needs, opportunities, and challenges of business and industry. I want to call your attention to just a couple of advertisements. One is that we are hosting a global sustainable bioenergy convention here in the cities in September, the last of five global series in this event, and you'll be getting, if you haven't, more information on that. Our E3 conference, which I know many of you have participated on, is expanding to a two-day conference this year on November 30th. And December 1st, on the second day, we're going to have sort of a deeper technical dive into a few areas, probably on wind energy and solar energy. I didn't have time to put it on the slide, but on the table out front is a notice of a smart grid meeting that's going to be held on the campus of the University of Minnesota next Wednesday. This is a year-long effort with a whole host of collaborators in state government and business and industry and the university to really develop significant traction in the smart grid arena to position ourselves, hopefully, for a successful outcome on the current DOE solicitation is out for smart grid. So in conclusion, what we all, I think, would agree that we need are these next-generation renewable energy systems that have multiple benefits, these so-called system approaches for economic, environmental, and energy security benefits. And I should add that we're not new to that need. And I'll simply close with this ancient Indian proverb that I think we all would agree is as relevant today as whenever it was concluded. So thank you very, very much, again, Senator Solon and Representative Hilly, for the chance to share with you some of what we've been up to. Thank you.
A lot of impressive stuff going on at the university. I found myself wishing that it had been possible for Dick or someone like him to have given that overview 25 years ago. I got to tell you a little story about myself and how I became aware of Dr. Martinson and his video, The Crash Course. December of 2008, before the beginning of the last biennial legislative session, at the time that we were facing a $6.3 billion revenue shortfall in this state, about 20% of the biennial budget, and the economy was climbing into the handbasket that it still remains in. The DFL House Caucus had a one-day retreat, which we discussed in various ways what to do in the upcoming session dealing with that deficit and with the economic conditions that we faced and unfortunately still do face. I won't go into any of that, but at the end of the day, members were invited, if they chose, to make a very brief statement about what their hopes were for the upcoming session, what they would regard as a satisfactory outcome. And I hadn't really intended to say anything, but after a number of comments that basically were sort of like end on time or hold K-12 education harmless and stuff like that, I felt compelled to say that my hope was that in dealing with all of the problems that we had to deal with in the upcoming session, we would learn enough about how we got to where we were that we would realize that the worst thing we could possibly do was to try to get back to where we were, because where we were was so far from where we needed to be that there isn't anything that we could do that would be in a worse direction. Well, as it chanced, the very next day, I happened across a link sent to me by my absolute favorite internet correspondent. I don't know if she's here or not, Wanda Ballantyne, are you here somewhere? sent a link to an interview, I think it was on Slate or Alternet, maybe Chris will remember, but it was an interview with Chris Martinson, who basically was describing in a relatively brief interview exactly what I had been thinking when I made that brief statement to the caucus the day before. And connected with that interview was a link to his website and to his video presentation called The Crash Course. I access that. It's about a 3-hour video, as some of you may know. I've distributed about 125 copies of that to colleagues and a number of others in the state, and I suspect that 5 or 10% of them have actually been watched. but it's about a 3-hour presentation, and I couldn't stop watching it. I started kind of late in the evening, and I just watched the whole thing because here was someone articulating extremely clearly and with all kinds of data to back it up exactly what I thought I had begun to understand about where we were and how we got there and what the implications were. So I have kind of pursued Chris since then, finally succeeded in getting him to come here and talk to us. I should mention that I subjected my energy committee to the entire three-hour presentation of the crash course at the beginning of the 2009 session. And I think it did make a significant impression on some of the members. One of the first things that Chris Martinson will tell you is that he's not an expert in any of the three fields that he speaks about: economy, energy, or the environment. And I've not asked Chris to speak today as a specialized expert, but as a generalist, a futurist, and mostly, as I particularly have realized in the conversations that we've had, a concerned citizen. He's a, I think, uniquely articulate, insightful, and even prophetic citizen. And in many respects, he's just a regular man out of concern for the future of his children, has made it his life's work to dig deeply into the greatest challenges that we face. Where he's anything but a regular man lies in the fact that he has correctly predicted some of the biggest events that most observers, even experts, mostly experts, have missed. On a sort of personal level, he invested in gold some 400% ago, foresaw the crash of the housing market, the decline of the dollar, and the stock market crash several years in advance, while most of the country still saw an unfettered bull market stampeding ahead indefinitely. I understand that Chris comes from a family with a long history in banking. His great-great-grandfather was a founder of the Canandaigua National Bank in upstate New York, and his grandfather served on the New York Federal Reserve Board. I would say a profound understanding of how money works seems to run in his veins. And this, combined with his corporate executive background, which I will not go into, allows him to serve as a translator, deciphering some of the most difficult and obscure topics in a cohesive, vivid picture that anyone can understand, I hope. I think you'll find a lot to ponder in the next 45 minutes or so. And I'm very happy to introduce Chris Martinson. I neglected to mention that cards have been distributed for questions. We will collect those as they are available. Staff will circulate, and we will have probably an hour, hour and a half for question and answer after the presentation. So thank you, and Chris.
All right.
It's all yours.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here. It's really my pleasure to be able to speak to you today. This has been a long journey to get to this particular spot for me. One thing I've learned in this business is it's okay to be a couple months ahead of your curve and, you know, a few months ahead of the situation. It's not okay to be 3 years ahead, which is where I was for a while with a number of other people. How many people have actually seen the crash course here? Okay, we can move to questions. What I want to do today is take basically what was 5 years of inquiry, which I did compress into about a full weekend's long seminar, which then became the crash course at 3.5 hours, and it's chopped into 20 chapters for those of you who haven't seen it, so you don't have to consume it all at once. And now we're going to compress that into 45 minutes. And I want to just impress upon you that what we're going to talk about today is really the tip of an iceberg. There's a lot of material behind this, but I think we can get the general gist of this story out in 45 minutes, and we can do that in a fairly complete and compelling way. So as I look around these days, and I bet you, like me, have been looking around and seeing all sorts of things happen that are not necessarily very comforting anymore. So here's a picture of what was formerly the most sophisticated drilling rig on the surface of the planet. This is our technological marvel, and it was staffed with the best of the best. You didn't just apply and end up on this rig. And a little over a month ago, it collapsed and burned. And this happened because there was a combination of technological challenges and technological errors and human errors that were coming to bear on one of the most complicated projects that we could possibly undertake. We were drilling down through 5,000 feet of water, a total depth of 18,000 feet, not even a drilling record, to get at a pool of oil that, if we could get it all out all at once, would actually run the entire world for 12 days. So this is the level of technology and the level of risk we're willing to entertain to find 12 days worth of something that we need on a global scale to run our economy. And as we look around the world, we might have noticed this is a picture from Greece. So it's suddenly been exposed to the world that Greece is not only insolvent, meaning that they have a mismatch between liabilities and assets, but they're actually bankrupt, meaning that there is no possible combination of spending cuts or economic growth or personal savings inside of their country that can possibly lift them out of the debt hole which they currently find themselves. But Greece was just a metaphor for what's going on in Ireland, in Greece, Portugal, Spain. And as we'll soon find out, the UK, Japan, and the United States as well. And we go further and we notice that from 2007 down to the depths of March 2009, the stock market basically got cut in half and then some. And over the past year, what's happened is it's climbed out of that a little bit and it's turned down a little bit again. How do these things connect? Is this just a random collection of events? The answer is no. All of these things are connected to each other. And it is my contention that unless we start to understand the actual underpinnings of these things, that we're going to have a very hard time trying to deal with them, because we'll be applying essentially Band-Aids on balloon pops. It won't work. So what I want to do today is have a discussion, an open discussion. First lecture format, we'll collect questions and we'll have a question-answer session to talk about how these things are really, truly interconnected and why we have to look at them in this particular way. So this becomes then the lens through which I look at the world. And there's a lot of different ones out there, but once I put this particular lens in front of my eyes, I couldn't seem to take it off. And that's the lens that we're going to talk about today. Bill started to give an introduction to some of it. I heard the same language coming out of Dick's presentation. This language is everywhere now. At the time when I first started this, it was relatively rare, and I'm really pleased to see that we're starting to connect these pieces, because we can't look at them individually anymore. The first piece is the economy. That's the primary orientation of the cube. If I'm looking at a cube, that's the primary way I face it. And I look through it, and there's a reason for that. First, we all care about the economy. We all care about having jobs. We care about our own individual economic circumstances. So that means I have a compelling way to enter into this story. But if you don't have a functioning economy, all of that brilliant, beautiful stuff that Dick was talking about won't happen. That takes highly coordinated, sophisticated, functioning supply chains and all sorts of interlocking and intersecting pieces to pull off. And I want that to happen. So I care deeply that our economy is functioning. This is not just a case of, well, I care about my pocketbook, so I'm going to talk about the economy. If we don't have a functioning economy, all the rest of it just becomes a story that we tell around campfires later. So I want the economy to function. In this story, I discovered that economies don't actually function on their own. They function as a consequence of having energy. No energy, you could have all the money in the world you want, but if you live on a rock without any energy on it, it doesn't really matter. Energy is the lifeblood. Energy is the actual thing upon which we build all of the other complexity in our society, with the economy being sort of a metaphor for our complex society. And there's a really interesting story to tell about energy, but it goes well beyond that, because we can tell a larger story as well around the environment. And the story I tell there is a story of resources. So maybe energy is just one resource, and I'm talking about other resources in the environment. But in fact, energy is its own substance. It needs to be thought of separately. And in the environment, I'm really concerned about resource depletion, particularly as the angle on this story. And when I look at all three of these things together in one spot, and I showed you some pictures of Greece and deep water, if we think about this like we're driving in a car, what we can, when I think of this, I think of this like we've got red and yellow warning lights just all over our national and even our global dashboards. And I think a prudent adult would pull over and say, what's going on here? What can we do to understand this? And is there anything that we can do about this? Of course there is. So what should we be doing about this? Well, I put all of it together and I come up with this one statement. I can boil the whole crash course down into the statement that the next 20 years are going to be completely unlike the last 20 years. Maybe that's not that bold of a statement. Of course they're going to be different. What I mean by this is that as a human, I'm a linear creature. I tend to predicate what's just about to happen on what's just happened. Right? So if I'm driving down a long straight road, my expectation is that it's going to keep being straight. If I come out of my house and slip on ice three mornings in a row, I hope on the fourth morning I've caught on that there's something there for me to look at. This is how we're wired. The reason I'm here today and the reason I've made this, telling this story, my life's work, is because I happen to believe that there's a very sharp corner coming in this particular story. And that's okay. We'll get around that corner and we'll be in a different place, but the extent to which we don't see that corner coming is the extent to which we're exposed. We're exposed to continuing on in our comfortable patterns, doing what we normally do, maintaining the status quo, not understanding that there's a chance that that story could really be changing at a fundamental level. So here's where it begins. It begins with money, something I honestly didn't even think about. Despite having got an MBA and having been in the corporate world, I sure knew how to compete for it. I just didn't understand how it came into being and why that was important. So I'm going to go through this part very quickly. It's a full 20 or 30 minutes on the crash course. I'm going to do it, I think, in 1 minute or 2 minutes here. There's only one thing I need you to understand about money. I don't care what color it is or whose picture's on it or what symbols you've got on it or what kind of anti-counterfeiting technology you're using. All money shares a single common trait. All money in the world today shares one common trait, and it's this. All money is loaned into existence. Now, this is a really actually very profound statement. There's a lot of ways you could get money into circulation. You could actually just issue it. In fact, we did that for long periods of time in our country's history. But we took a departure from that a while ago, roughly 100 years. And as of today, all money is loaned into existence. Well, what do we know about loans? Well, loans have a principal portion and an interest portion. Well, this is where the interesting part of this story comes into play. This is such an important concept. I'm going to call it a key concept for the moment. I'm going to say that, you know, all money loaned into existence, hold on to that, but it means something. And here's the implication from that particular statement. It means that at any moment in time, there is always more debt in our culture or in any culture that uses the same type of money, which is now all of them. There's always more debt in existence than there happens to be money. Always. If you don't understand the theory behind it, I can give you empirical data. Today, in the United States, according to the Federal Reserve, there is $52 trillion of total credit market debt outstanding. State debt, federal debt, local debt, corporate, private. $52 trillion. How much money is there out in the banking system we can identify? Somewhere between $10 and $12 trillion. So the story goes like this. Well, if I have all this debt and I have to pay it off, how am I going to do that? I'll loan you the money to pay it off. But aren't my debts larger now? Yes. Well, you know, you think about that for a minute or two, you go, well, hold on, there might be a wrinkle in this story somehow. And the wrinkle is this. It's actually not a problem as long as you can perpetually continue to expand. Because if you can keep loaning new money, I mean, what does money do for us? Money is just a reflection. It's a way for us to store wealth. It's a way for us to store or delay our need for gratification for needs, goods, services that we want to buy. So as long as those needs, goods, services are expanding, everything's okay. So I can flip this key concept around and rephrase it slightly, and it's just as true. It means that perpetual growth, then, is a requirement of our modern banking system. 2% worldwide growth, everything's okay. That was 2008. 2% negative growth in the world economy, and it's fire and brimstone. And that was 2009. When I say it's a requirement, I don't mean a legal requirement. It's not written down in a document somewhere. I mean that our banking system operates reasonably well as long as it's incrementally growing by some percentage every year, and it does extremely poorly, as 2009 will attest, if that slips into even slight amount of reverse territory. So here's a graph of United States debt situation. This is debt to GDP. That's gross domestic product. And so this is total debt. And this chart goes all the way from your left, from the 1920s, all the way on up to current. Right? You see a big blip there early on the left side of the chart? That's the Great Depression. That blip is not a whole lot of debt being taken on during the 30s. Rather, that's the GDP portion of that equation falling so dramatically that even as the debt was shrinking a little bit, GDP fell away so badly that it made that spike. Absent that little spike in the 30s, you will notice that this chart is never above 200%, all the way on up until we get to this period here. Right? This is actually coincides with the beginning of the Reagan administration. It progressed through every other administration since, so that is not a partisan statement on my behalf. It's just an observation that sometime in the early 80s, we took a departure in this country. And it was a fairly significant departure. But that period, through that green section right there, if that's the last 20 years, in order for the next 20 years to look like those, that yellow line has to continue going off in that direction at about the same pace, with no interruption. But there's an implicit assumption baked into ever-growing amounts of debt. And that assumption is this, that the future is going to be larger than the present. We're going to have a larger GDP. We're going to have more goods and services. Because when you're constantly increasing debts, we are collectively making the bet that there will be something to pay off those debts with in the future. So we've made a very large, very profound, hugely collective bet that the future is going to be a lot larger than the present. And that's how our system is geared. Again, I'm not saying it's pro or con. I'm not here to cast judgment. There's such value in describing the system that I'm just trying to explain this is where we are, and here's some context for where we are. All right? So as we look forward, we find that, you know, the United States is not unique in this regard. If you can't see that from the back, we've got eight countries strung across this graph on the bottom, and it's comparing the actual total amount of official debt that we tell ourselves about. So if you open up the Washington Post and you say, you know, United States debt to GDP, not as bad as, you know, pick one, Greece's or Japan's. What they're talking about is that stuff in that little blue box down at the bottom. That's the debt we talk about. But if you were a corporation or a pension fund or a state, you would have to account for yourself using this larger bar, which is the green bar, which is the total net liabilities of the country. So that includes in that green bar for the United States federal government, that's entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. That includes all liabilities. So you might notice here that the United States, rather than being in far better shape than anybody else, is way over here on the right side of the graph. Way over on the left side, the furthest one over, if you can't read it on the left, is Spain. And now the world's all a Twitter about Spain. Can Spain possibly pay its debts back? It's way over leveraged. It can't. So I just want to put this in context and say that this is not a United States story. This is a global story. Something in this story went just wide and very broad and all over the place. But the United States is absolutely not in any better or in necessarily any worse shape than anybody else. We have the same story operating now. So I would invite you, as you're reading stories about Greece or Spain and about how their problems seem economically insolvable, you could just, in your mind, mentally insert United States into that same article you're reading, and that might be something that you would be reading about in a few years down the road. So this is a challenge. It's looming out there. It's absolutely real. Now, the economy then, I can give you a shorthand. I can shorten the whole economy. Everything you need to know about the economy can fit into two words. It must grow. That's how it's defined. That's how we set it up. Because we have debt-based money, because that's how we organized ourselves, our economy runs really well in growth mode and actually runs pretty poorly when it can't grow. In fact, the concept of growth is so entrained in our lexicon that when you read open up a newspaper, an economist talks about that minus 2% situation, you know what they call that? Negative growth. We don't even have words for it. It's like, oh, that's growth and that's negative growth. So it must grow. Here's how economists see the world. Everybody fresh on your calculus? Are you good? No? No. All right. So I'm going to let me simplify this equation for you. You move a few terms around. You balance the left and the right. And there it is. That's the formula from the Federal Reserve website, and it describes how our economists are trained in all of the best universities to catalog and characterize our economy in economic terms, and this calculus equation is the equation for economic growth. And if you could look at this, you would see it's not just any type of growth, but it's a special type of growth. It requires some percentage growth each year in order for this equation to really be happy and for our economy to work well. What does it mean when something's growing by a percent or two a year, or 10% or 1%? Actually, the amount doesn't matter. It means that that thing is growing exponentially. exponential growth. Now, this is a concept we're going to spend a couple minutes on because exponential growth, it's not linear. I just finished telling you we're humans, we're linear. Exponential growth is not linear. Here's an example. So if I gave you two bricks and I said, I want you to move them together at an even pace and I'll score you on how well you do, and you'd probably be able to pull them together. Now I'm going to give you two magnets, north facing out, south facing out. I'm going to say, move them together at a perfectly even pace from start to finish, and you won't be able to do it. I'll give you 100 shots at it, too. Our brains just aren't wired that way. Even though your muscles could handle the job, it's just something confusing because they don't pull linearly. So let's spend a little bit of time. What is exponential growth? Well, it looks like a hockey stick chart. That's what exponential growth is. You see this, we're graphing an amount of something on the vertical axis over time, on the horizontal axis. An amount of something over time. This could be McDonald's hamburgers sold, number of people on the face of the planet. It could be, you know, reams of paper run through Kinko's copiers. Whatever it happens to be, as long as that thing that we're graphing is growing by some percentage amount, year over year over year, or any unit of time, it'll look like this chart. And in fact, this is a real chart. This is a chart of world population, which has been growing at a little over a percent a year for quite a long time. So what I've done here is stretch this out across the bottom. That's thousands of years. So this is a 7,000-year-long graph and billions of people on the other axis. The green part is history, and the red part is the next 40 years, according to the UN. Now, we notice that this chart has this long, slow, flat part, and then, whoop, suddenly turns the corner. Anybody who's math-minded is thinking, oh, this guy's trying to pull a fast one. That's not cool. Because, in fact, by fiddling with that left axis, that vertical one, I can make this chart look any way I want. Instead of going to 12 billion, if I made this go to 1,000 billion, that chart would just flatten right out and you wouldn't see any hockey stick. Or if I ran it to 1 billion on the left axis instead of 12, I'd be giving this talk in 1810 telling you about what a problem we have, because it would have gone vertical back then. But why is it fair to talk about it this way? Well, it becomes fair if and only if you can fix that left axis. If you know, like, I can't fiddle that, like I can't go to 1,000 billion, because we don't think we can fit that many people on. In fact, this little capstone I've put on this is the range of estimates from scientists who say, well, when we look at food, water, energy, all that stuff, we think about how many people could possibly be sustained. It's probably somewhere in that zone. So we have a pretty good idea of how many people we can fit sustainably on the planet under current conditions, and that includes a lot of oil. So we have a number of complexities to this story. I just want to get across that as long as we can fix that axis, though, this turning the corner, that little elbowy thing, is actually vitally important. It has huge implications. And so we're going to spend just a couple minutes exploring that. Here's oil production over time, starting from the 1800s on through. And you'll notice the same sort of a shape. I use production because production and consumption are the same thing. We have about 50 days storage above ground on the world. So once it gets pumped, it gets used. And we look at this and we say, yeah, look, it had that, it's got this steep curve part here. But we have a reasonably good idea now of where the cap goes on this story. Yeah, there's some disagreement. Is peak oil 40 years out or is it 4 years ago? We don't know. We're in the range, though. It's actually in the range of my children's lifetimes for sure, probably mine as well. Might have already happened. So all of a sudden, you know, where we are in this chart has enormous implications for us. And I would submit to you, because we know how much oil we can pump out of the ground on a flow rate with pretty good precision at this moment in time. And by the way, the deep water incident is only going to exacerbate that because the deep water finds happen to have been roughly 40% of all the oil, future oil that we're counting on getting, 40% of that was all slated to come from deep water. So just a six-month moratorium is going to cost us around 500,000 barrels a day in a couple of years. If the moratorium lasts a year, it'll probably cost us 1 million barrels a day. And these are incredibly important terms to understand right now because of how tight we are in the world's supply-demand balance at this point in time. So I could pull up a whole bunch of hockey stick charts. Water use, species extinction, fisheries exploited, forest loss, all of this. We can find them everywhere. And the point I want to make is not to really, you know, pull up all of these semi-distressing charts. It's just say, look, we happen to live in a nonlinear world. You're surrounded by exponential charts. This is the world in which we live. So understanding that a little bit better is actually one of the key elements of this entire story. And we're going to spend just a second going through that, because I want to make sure we really get this exponential growth thing. I want to make sure that when we see these hockey stick charts, we have a slight understanding of this. So for the two people who haven't seen the crash course, I'm going to ask everybody else to zip it through this part, okay? Just shh. So here's a way I like to illustrate this. I have this magic eyedropper, and it's magic because when I drop this drop of water out, that drop of water is going to double every minute. So if I put a drop of water out and I wait a whole minute, I have two drops, and another minute, and I have four drops. And after 6 minutes, I can fill a thimble up. So if you have a sense of that growth, I want you to follow me now. We're going down to the Metrodome. We're going to go there tomorrow. It's my story, so two things are going to happen. First, I've made the Metrodome completely watertight. And the second thing I've done is I've handcuffed you to the highest row of bleacher seats. So you people in the back row, just pretend you know you got a handcuff on right now. And the question I want to ask you is, if at 12 o'clock tomorrow, you're already handcuffed to the bleacher seats, I go down onto the 50-yard line way out in the center, and I bend over and I put my magic eyedropper, I drop a drop out, so small you can't possibly see it. The question is this: if we did that at 12 o'clock tomorrow, how much time do you have to escape from your handcuffs? Weeks, months, days, minutes, years, seconds? What are some guesses?
Hours?
Days? A few days?
6 hours?
The answer is you have 50 minutes. And if it turns out I completely miscalculated and I got it, I was off on the volume of the Metrodome by 100%, I'm off by a minute. So think 12:51 if you want. All right, here's the important part of this question. At what time is this entire stadium still 97% empty space? A little bit of water on the field. And how many of you realize the seriousness of your predicament? Close. Very close. 12:45. 45 minutes, we fill up 3% of the park. 5 more minutes, all the rest is done. All of human history to 1960 to get to 3 billion people. Only 40 more years to add the next 3 billion people. I did that with people, but I could do that in a number of other ways. So this tells us that where you are on that curve is vitally important. Is the water just starting to spread across the infield? That's where my great-great-grandfather was, I think. Is the water coming up the stairs at a clip? That's where I happen to be. Knowing where you are in that particular story is really incredibly vitally important. So here's an illustration of that. I'm going to return to this oil consumption chart, or production. Either way, same terms. Here's oil shock one. I've marked it, hopefully, big blue arrow. This is when Jimmy Carter came out and gave one of the most prescient speeches. You could read it today and say, wow, that was perfect. You know, unfortunately, he did it in 1977. And he completely identified the nature of our predicament with respect to oil and our dependency on it. And the mistake I think people might take is that it took another 40 years, give or take, to get to oil shock 2, which was really marked by the $147 a barrel we hit in July of 2008. So the mistake would be to think, well, we had 30 years between those two, so we're going to have 30 years to the next one, right? We're not in remotely similar places on this story. We're in completely dissimilar places in this story because we had roughly 40 years so we were going to hit peak production, or maybe 60. You know, there's a little wiggle when Jimmy Carter gave that speech, but we're anywhere between 0 and 20 on the story now. The water's up the stairs, not the same story. So the mistake would be to think that because we've been through this before and we handled it by basically ignoring it, that we can do that again. And it'll work out the same way. Different part of the story. So exponential charts are everywhere. It's absolutely a key concept. There's very few things in our lives that are actually marked by linear processes right now because of a number of factors. But the thing I really want you to take away from that whole thing around exponential growth, what's important about that? It's about speeding up. It's about how time does not operate linearly through that story, speeding up. So when I ran through that retinue of issues up front, you know, we got the deep water thing, it looks like, you know, financial systems are going, things are speeding up. I mean, does anybody share that impression with me that, okay, those guys do. Really, so this speeding up, this is my framework for understanding it. I understand that we live in a complex, nonlinear world, and that it's all exponential charts, so of course things are speeding up. That's the nature of it, of the beast in that case. So I want to talk about problems versus predicaments. Problems have solutions, where the solution will roughly get you back to where you started. Predicaments have outcomes. Knowing the difference between the two makes all the difference in the world if you are having to make decisions. So look at these guys. These guys have a problem on their hands, right? For anybody who's a rock climber, I apologize. Totally bogus picture. But think of the solutions we could entertain here. I don't know. Somebody could push a big mattress underneath, or maybe a rope could get lowered down. Maybe the guy climbs onto the rock and climbs himself down. But there are solutions to this. Whereas this gentleman has a predicament on his hands. No matter how fast he pinwheels his arms, he's not going to go up and stay dry. He's getting wet. And now he's got to manage his outcome. Is he going to belly flop or is he going to land on his feet? So it's really critical to understand right now. I see a lot of things that are being applied as though they are solutions. Particularly the bank bailout was a set of solutions that were applied to a predicament. The predicament in that case, and this is my personal assessment, was that we were laboring under too much debt. How you solve that by bailing out those institutions is unclear to me because I view it as a predicament, where I truly believe our policymakers at the time viewed it as a problem that could be solved. And having that framework, understanding where you are and whether you're facing a problem or a predicament, is really critical to the choices you'll make next. So let's talk about energy, because this is the source of everything as far as I am concerned. This is U.S. oil production over the period from 1920 through to current. And you'll notice that we peaked here in the early 70s, 1970, 71, depending on who's counting. And we produce about half that much today, despite finding the North Sea field, which was the largest field ever discovered, despite all of our efforts and technological prowess. Whatever we've done, we have the most drilled continent on the face of the planet. I mean, we've really applied some amazing efforts here. Incredible technological advances have happened. Despite all of that, despite all of our intentions, we're about halfway down from where we started at the peak there in the 70s. And to make up the difference, we import the rest, right? So we import, that wedge is about to scale. We import about two-thirds of our petroleum needs into this country now. Individual states, Minnesota does not have any liquid fuels production coming out of the ground, so Minnesota's in an import situation with respect to this. So that's our dependency. That right there, the fact that we went past peak oil in this country is now, it's not a problem to be solved with extra holes drilled in the ground. It's just a predicament. So we manage it. We manage it best we can. And this is just a fact of life that we have to deal with, is that we are 40 years past peak in this country. That's where we happen to be in this particular story. This chart, when it came out in 2008, shocked me to no end. This is a chart put out by the International Energy Agency, part of their World Energy Outlook. Came out in October of 2008. From 2007, when I'd been tracking in 2006, all the way on back, they'd always produced their estimate of how much oil was going to come out of the ground by running the economic numbers and saying, well, how much do we need? And then the oil was a plug factor. They said, well, the economy is going to grow 3% per year, so we need 3% more oil per year. And they would say, great, we're getting to 130 million barrels per day by 2030. That was their estimate for 2030 back in 2007. So along comes 2008, and I'm expecting the same report, and I open it up, and oh my gosh, they did something different. This time they looked at all the oil fields in the world, all of them, all the big ones, and added them all up in a spreadsheet and ran the sum process on the column and said, So the first thing they did is they realized that we're not getting to 130 million barrels per day. We're probably going to max out at 105 million barrels. That's where this chart goes to. That was shocker number one. Shocker number two is, see that big blue spot on the bottom, that biggest part? That's crude oil from currently producing fields. And that red line was when I first put this chart together in 2009. I could move it a little further to your right. The IEA admitted flat out that we are already well past peak of conventional oil. Now, conventional oil is a euphemism for cheap and easy, right? You stick a straw in the ground and the stuff comes out under pressure, and it's not under 18,000 feet of overburden in the deep water. It's on land somewhere, and you put a straw in and out it comes. We're past peak on that stuff. This cannot be overemphasized. That this chart came out and wasn't on the front of every newspaper in the world was a real shocker to me, but it's been 2 years since, practically, a year and a half, and still it sits there waiting for people to discover it. We are past peak conventional oil. And I think the Deepwater incident really just puts an exclamation point on that, but this was already well known to people who've been observing this. And if you look at where we're going to make up and get to that 105 million barrels, where we're going to get there is the next big blue, light blue wedge there is crude oil from fields yet to be developed, so we're pretty sure we know where they are, but we just haven't hit them yet. And that red wedge, that next one, is from crude oil from fields yet to be found. So, trust me, they didn't have a spreadsheet they built that wedge from. That's how that one was put together. Well, there was a task force, the industry task force on peak oil out of the UK. Richard Branson's Virgin was part of that. There were four other companies involved. Industry came together, all of them interested in how much oil we've got. So it was an airline industry, a power industry, et cetera. They did their own analysis, and it was very rigorous, and I saw the data from it, and they said, 105, honestly, max. We think 92 to 98 is going to be the range. So I put a block in there, again, showing the possible cap of the maximum flow rate that we might get to. And we now have multiple sources of confirming evidence from different places, from the IEA, from the industry task force, and from this next chart I'm about to show you, which also made my hair just stand on end, what's left of it. Look at this. This came from our own Department of Energy. The gentleman in charge of putting this report together, which is our own internal United States Department of Energy report on oil, Glenn Sweetnam, put this chart together and went out and delivered it. And so this shows that according to the Department of Energy in this internal analysis that they had done, that we are going to have to make up the gap between here and there with unidentified projects. We don't know what they are at this point. But they had done something I'd never seen done before, was they put the peak at 2011 for worldwide oil production. Well, guess what? He got reassigned. He's currently unavailable for comment, and they won't talk about it. It's a personnel matter, and they pulled the chart. But out it came. This was actually an internal document. And it's all over the web now, so it's forget about it. Can't get that back. So here we have the Department of Energy, the International Energy Agency, an industry task force, plus all the bloggers out there, all kind of triangulating on this window that says, woo, 2010 to 2013, that's peak. And that's only if everything goes according to plan, which we found out a month ago. That doesn't always work out. So this is a very serious thing, because energy is how we run our entire society in many large respects. It's the most important commodity we've got. It's not like any others. So quantity of oil is an issue. Quantity of oil. Just how many millions of barrels are we going to get out? That's one. You'll read about this in the paper more and more if you care to look. This story is out there. But there's another story that's not out there nearly as strongly yet that's just as important. I want to talk about what it means when we go out and find energy. So it takes energy to get energy, right? You know, if you're going to put up a big drill platform, somebody had to smelt the steel and do the specialty stuff and bring all the people there. Trust me, a lot of energy is involved, huge amounts. So one other way we could look at it is forget how many dollars it costs to drill a well in the Gulf. Tell me how much energy we get back for the energy we had to put in. And this chart is just a theoretical representation of that. The green part then is looking at the energy we get out, right? And the red part is the energy we had to put in. And so what you're looking at on this chart, it goes from 100% on the left across the bottom. This is asking all the way at the left, where you see a 50, if you can see it all the way on the left, starts at 50. The 50 says, we put one barrel of oil into the situation, we got 50 back. It's a huge return, right? Expressed in percentage terms, that means we got 98% back. We put 2% in, got 98% back. That's what 1 to 50 represents. And we trundle along this story, and we find that, you know, this red part, the energy that's used to get energy, this is not a linear story again. You'll notice it has a sort of a nonlinear feel to it. The green part is the surplus energy. So we put 50, one barrel in, got 50 out. We get to do whatever we want with those 49 surplus barrels we got out of that story. We can do whatever we want. You know, we can hold dog shows and, you know, have soccer practice 4 hours away and, you know, have build 777 wide bodies, all this great stuff. That's what we do with the surplus energy. But we have to think about the energy it took to get that. Again, I don't care about the dollar component of this or the monetary cost. And you'll notice that this chart crosses the boundary at one. It crosses at one because after you're investing one barrel to get one back, you might as well stop. You know, you're just spinning your wheels at that point. There's no gain. And in this story, these numbers are a little bit fuzzy because we don't have a good solid commission studying this yet, but we have some rough numbers we can work with. Once upon a time in the 1930s, we were getting 100-to-1 returns. Stick a straw on the ground. You know those old famous black and white photos of, like, there's this little tiny derrick made out of wood and it's got this huge gusher coming out the top, right? Spindle top formation, Texas being one example, where we turned that whole inland sea into a lake of oil at one point because we couldn't figure out how to stop the oil. So we were getting these 100-to-1 returns, and then in the 70s, you know, we think we're getting more closer to 25-to-1 because the oil's a little deeper. We have to go a little further for it. But look at all the green under that. That's still almost all green. So that's awesome. And then in the 90s, maybe 18-to-1 to 10-to-1 are the returns that we were getting out of oil. So it's still a huge amount of green under that. But when we start thinking about oil today, there are estimates that the effort that was just underway in the Gulf was going to return something closer to 3-to-1. That's okay, right? I mean, we're putting one barrel in, we're getting three back, so we're doing good, right? Well, I want you to think about that green part as the energy required to create the social complexity that you see around you. All the different job specialties we have, the fact that we have over 10 billion different stock-keeping units, if you want to look at it that way, available to us in our stores, the fact that we have just-in-time delivery systems that span 12,000 miles or more, all of that complexity is driven by that green part. And so if we start running our society entirely on 3-to-1 energy, it starts to look like this. And if we choose to run our society on corn-based ethanol, which has a fairly low energy return, I don't care about the economics of it, I'm just talking energy, we would try and squeeze our society into a story that looks like this. It's just a very different story. It means that understanding how much energy we are getting back from our efforts is a really important, vital part of this story. Hey, should we spend $1 billion on a light rail system or should we spend $1 billion retrofitting and re-insulating existing structures? I don't know. Which one has the best energy return to us? We can't answer those questions often because we actually don't have the base data for those particular pieces of story, but that's an important angle that needs to be thought about along with the social elements and the political elements and the economic elements. I submit that understanding the energy element is a really critical part of this story. All right? So it means that the quality of our energy is a really important component of this story. So both quantity and quality. This quality component is still not fully expressed out there in the news yet, but it's starting to creep in a little bit, but it's not quite there yet. So now we have an economy that really must grow, and it bases a lot of its growth on having access to energy. And so now we have maybe some adult-sized concerns that we can look through the windshield of this car we're driving and see the end of that growth in energy, at least the way we're used to it. And maybe we could characterize energy in this story as something that can't grow. And again, I want to remind you, in that growing it, quantity is one thing. How many millions of barrels we get out of the ground, that's one thing. But how much net energy we get is the other thing. And we have to think about both those pieces together. So that's that part of the story. In the environment, we have a similar story to tell. It's remarkably similar. This is an image of a couple of gentlemen. It's not that long ago because cameras were invented, right? But this is at pretty much around the time that the Industrial Revolution really kicked off and began. And they're sitting on a copper nugget, which is that's pretty amazing. And eventually we didn't find any more of those, so we went to smaller ones, and that's great. You know, we still had these beautiful, high-quality copper nuggets that we could turn to, and then we ran out of those. And so, of course, we turned to the next best thing, the high-grade copper ores. Look at this beautiful green stuff, nice high 10% grade. And today, this is what our copper mines look like. It's the largest copper mine or mine in America at this point, the Bingham Canyon Mine. That used to be a mountain. It is now a hole in the ground, 3/4 mile deep, 2.5 miles across. And the ore grade that's coming out of it is 0.2%. And we're not doing that because we like to give our engineers an extra challenge. We're doing it because that's what we've got left. So think about that for just a second, if you would. 150 years of industrial revolution, and that's what I care about. We have an industrial economy. In 150 years, we've gone from copper nuggets the size of small cars to holes in the ground that look like this. And we're not doing that, again, because we like the challenge. We're doing that because in only 150 years, we're starting to have to prosecute resources of lesser and lesser and lesser grades, which only makes sense. But 150 years, in all honesty, is a blink of an eye when we talk about things from a historical perspective. So resource extraction profiles look like this. First, you go out and you find all the big nuggets, and then you find the little nuggets, and then you get the lesser grade ores, and further until finally, you know, you're down to the stuff that's not even worth getting out of the ground because the return just isn't there. And we sum across all of those, and we find out that we basically, for almost anything we care to look at, we find bell curves, meaning that we started to think lead was important. We started to mine lead, and then we got a lot out of the ground, and it became hard to find. And we can tell that story across dozens of key minerals at this point in time. Dozens of them. Many of them we can look forward. In the case of silver, for example, known silver mines, we can look forward and say there's only 15 years left that we know about that we can pull out of the ground. After that, I don't know where it's coming from. So we can actually see the physical end of known resource stocks in, again, well within the confines of my life. So in this resource extraction profile, we can say a couple things about it. The first is that the amount of energy required to get that lesser grade stuff doesn't go up linearly. It goes up like that, right? So think about the difference between hauling 0.2% ore out of the bottom of a pit that's 3/4 of a mile deep all the way up to the surface and then crushing it and processing it compared to taking a big nugget and moving it over and banging it into whatever shape you wanted, right? There's a huge difference in energy required in those two stories. And, of course, side by side with that then, we could also say that the cost, the dollar cost, what we would perceive to be the dollar cost would rise again exponentially or non-linearly in this particular story. So we're going to find as we go forward and prosecute remoter, deeper, more dilute resources that are just general costs are going to rise. We'll experience them as costs. But really the underpinning of that story is the energy that was required. Because we can either use energy to go and grow food or get ourselves off to vacation spots or to mine copper. We can do whatever we want with it. So the energy is going to be the key part that's really starting to drive that story from underneath. So now we have a situation where we have an economy that really must grow by its design, how it's currently designed. It's connected to an energy system that we can reasonably say we're going to have a lot of difficulty growing in terms of its overall amounts in quantity and quality. And we have clear, obvious signs of resource depletion that are now out there on the horizon that are, again, things that we're going to have to deal with. The question before us then really is, what are we facing? You know, how are we going to meet those challenges? Because in both the environment and in the energy stories, quantity and quality, both of those same principles apply in both cases, right? So the question then is this. Is this a problem or is this a predicament? Meaning, are there simple solutions that we could entertain or reasonably hope will come forward? Or do we have to think about starting to change because we're going to have to manage an outcome? What really is the story that we're facing? And that's the key subject that I really want to get to, because this is the heart of the whole story. And whether you fully believe that I've told a correct story or not, or maybe there's a different interpretation, I will say, as a quick aside, I've been waiting for somebody to come along and say, here's where you have that all wrong. And I haven't been challenged yet in a serious way. I've had a few people come up and say, you're underestimating how clever people are, which might be true. But it's not really a serious rejoinder. I mean, a serious rejoinder is, let's talk about the data and talk about ways in which this story could actually be off. Show me where there are the resources we need to continue in the same path on which we've been. Now, the story will just get told in a slightly different direction, and that's okay. But the mistake would be to think we're just going to continue what we had through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, when most of us were either developing or growing into adulthood. During those periods, thinking that that's just going to continue, I'm submitting, might be an error of thinking. So what are the implications? I've been watching with amusement and then growing concern as world governments and central banks have just dumped trillions of dollars or euros or yen into the system. And I understand why they're doing that, because in the past, if you ever wanted to stimulate economic development, what you did was you did this. You just dumped piles and piles of money out. Eventually, the engine sputtered back to life, and we all got back onto business as usual, and it worked. Now there are troubling signs that it's not working, and that's a really deeply disturbing principle or idea to a lot of the people who are in charge of this, because it's supposed to work. The problem, I think, is that they're just looking through the economic lens and just dumping money in, and there's something missing in this story, and that is that we don't have the same throughput of energy that we used to have. It's not only the same throughput, but it's not the same quality. And those have hidden costs that just sort of ripple throughout the whole system in a number of ways. And so here's my prediction. My prediction is, if my story is right, we're going to dump as much money as we possibly can until we see it sputter back to life, and it won't work again. And it'll be deeply confusing for people who are fully enmeshed in the economic story. And so we'll continue to see things like economic unemployment, which just doesn't, for whatever reason, just dumping money in doesn't seem to cure it for some odd reason. We're going to find that this world of budget cuts is going to be a more persistent feature rather than a one-time feature that we just have to get through in this one cycle, and by next cycle it'll all be cured. A number of states are really coming to grips with that, Minnesota among them, but California, my own state, Massachusetts, have all started to come to grips with the fact that you can't just continually shove stuff into the next cycle, because we're two cycles deep now, and it looks like we've got a third one at least. So this could be a persistent feature of failing to recognize that the story, the narrative, has started to change in some fundamental way. It means that the amount of volatility we've seen in our financial markets is now a feature of them, rather than something that we just have to manage and we can hope will go away soon. Because markets are really a reflection of all the people in the world coming to grips with whatever information they've got at hand. And it's been an amazing process to me to see, just last week, in fact, one of the world's most respected fund managers, very secretive guy, only has given a couple talks in his whole career, which spans back to the early 80s. He's returned 19.1% every year on average since he started in 1982. He's pretty good at what he does. And he recently gave a speech which was very close to saying, I'm throwing in the towel on this. None of this makes sense to me anymore. I don't get it. And so it's very concerning to me when we see people who have been that deeply enmeshed in the former story starting to come out and say, I don't get the story anymore. What's going on here? And so that's really, the complete aspect of what I want to talk about is that the implications of this are that we have to start doing things really differently, or expect, or at least allow us a little bit of latitude to start doing things just a little bit differently. So what do we do? I think that in my own work, this is no longer about left versus right, rich versus poor, old versus young, East Coast, West Coast, Eastern religion, Western religion. None of those apply to me anymore. I don't really care about that stuff. I pay attention to it, but it's not where I focus. People who've been to my website know that, we just did a year-end review with my small team, and we looked at the websites linking in to my site, and there are 800 and some linking in, and we were trying to bin them and say, who's linking in? And we couldn't figure it out because there were Daily Kos had linked in, John Birch had linked in, so we kind of had the political spectrum covered. We had this whole green contingent who was linking in, and NASCAR, all religions. And so we couldn't really figure it out, but that was one of my intents, was to create a story which we strip out all of those old divisions because those no longer matter. This is everybody's story. This is all of our collective story. And so it needs to be told that way. So I no longer think about left versus right. I honestly think that because the water is so far up the stairs that now we're going to be measured by our children and their children in terms of, did we make the right choices or did we make the wrong choices? Not where we were on some other left-right spectrum. So our choices really, really matter now. When the water's just in the infield, you have time to fiddle around, order a hot dog, maybe try a paperclip or something, just not be that serious about it, right? But when the water's a little bit further up, your choices really matter now. And so to me, this is exactly where we are. It's on that, shift the spectrum. It's no longer this way, it's whoop, this way. And the work, as I see it, is first we have to build a critical mass of awareness. You can't really, at a political level, certainly you cannot start to tackle a problem until a significant majority, if not a critical mass of people, believe that you have something that's worth working on. So we have to start by raising awareness. Raising awareness meaning, let's talk about, are we in a problem or are we in a predicament? If we're in a predicament, what's it look like? And if we're there, then what can we possibly do? But first we have to start raising that awareness, and awareness isn't good enough, right? I'm driving along and my red light comes on my dashboard and I pull over, I'm aware I have engine trouble. But if I don't understand how my engine works, anything I do personally to that engine is probably going to be a mistake. So I think that we should actually go from awareness into understanding. This means we have to take time with this material. It's really, I understand, it's got a lot of implications. It stretches everywhere. So we need to deepen what we know, and we're thinly aware of, into a deeper understanding to even begin to know what to do. And then we work into solutions or intelligent responses if it happens to be a predicament we're in. So that's the work as I see it. This needs to be done all along the way. In fact, I suggest that we could have people in. I love hearing about all the stuff that Dick was talking about that's being done with respect to alternative energy, because I am a huge fan of, and I believe technology is going to play a really important role. But we also need to have other responses going on in parallel with those efforts. And so this is the work as I see it. And I think we have to, paradigm is one of those really overused words, particularly in business school. I came to hate it, but I'm going to use it. Because I think it applies here. This is an example where I think it does. Here's an example. So the old paradigm, one thing we could count on, even if we weren't aware of it, was that we had more energy available to us every year than we did the year prior. What if the new future looks like slightly less energy is available to us each year, either on a total aggregate basis or on a net energy basis, or both? Right? That's a completely different landscape. In fact, it's a landscape that as a species we've never encountered before. There was always one more horizon. There was always one new well. There was always one new place to go to. Sometimes the wags who poo-poo the peak oil idea, they say, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. Right. Pretty good argument, But we went from basically wood heat to coal heat to oil. And I need to know what that next thing is, that question mark. What's out there? And we don't really have that defined yet. So I think we're going to have to face up to the fact that if peak oil has really happened, and I believe on a net energy basis it has, because we already have confirmed evidence that we're past conventional oil peak. Even if we get slightly more liquid out every year, we're past the cheap, easy, high net energy, high quality stuff. So we're going to have to get used to this, slightly less energy each year. That's a whole new landscape. The old paradigm was we had more resources every year, more copper, more lumber, more flat screen TVs, more whatever. We had more and more, we could reliably count on it. What if the new world, over the next few years, till we figure this all out, we have to deal with fewer resources? Well, what does that mean? Well, it completely changes the landscape. It means that reduce, reuse, recycle are no longer a nice term that a certain portion of the population uses because it makes them feel good. It becomes a necessity in order for us to even remotely continue to live in the fashion to which we've become accustomed. It changes everything once we get that into our thinking. What if we could count on reliable economic growth every year? That was sort of a part of the past. Even if recessions happen now and then, you could always count on them digging themselves out and continuing on. What if the new paradigm says that we have to find a way to operate with slightly less economic activity as we used to measure it happening every year? It's a possibility. I'm not saying we should just all thunder over and start pretending as if that new paradigm is absolutely right, but we ought to be dedicating just some resources to wrestling with the idea that that might be true. The implication of all of that to me is that we absolutely have to leave room for non-status quo solutions, completely non-status quo solutions. I was at a large gathering recently where I was trying to explain all of this, and I was with some people who were very enmeshed into the D.C. political scene, and I got lawyered up inside of 2 minutes. They're like, oh, no, hold on, you can't do that because you understand, and these guys won't go for that, and then we'll have to do this. And by the time we were done with the conversation, I realized that nothing was possible within the current paradigm because the things that we need to do are so far out of the box that it's not reasonable to expect that we'll be able to change the existing system in time to meet this challenge if this is true. So we need to find a way to allow some latitude for really non-status quo stuff to happen out there. And I don't know all the implications of that yet or what that really means, but I do trust that if we could create space for it, we'll figure it out because people are really creative and clever that way. I do have faith in that. And it's really important that we get the story right. I mean, I'm going back to story time here. So stop me if you've heard this story before. Housing always goes up in price. That was a story. We had that all the way up till 2006. That was a story. It drove a lot of decisions. We made a lot of decisions on the basis of that all across the country. It turned out it was the wrong story. It doesn't always go up in price. Oops, right? So having the right story in play is critically important. If you have the wrong story, it can really serve against you. This is just one example. So that old new paradigm, I was talking about numbers of ways in which the story is fundamentally different from one side of that column to the other side. You know, reliable economic growth every year is one story. Slightly less economic activity every year is a completely different story. Which one's in play? Because it totally will shape everything that we do or think. It means that we need a vision. It means that the people who are in leadership positions, they have to start providing the vision of where we're going and how we're going to get there. In the absence of that, people will make it up on their own. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of communities in our country and across the world, many of whom I've had the pleasure of visiting, who are doing exactly that. They're saying, I'm not waiting for the federal guys to figure it out. I'm not waiting for the state guys to figure out. We're going to take control in our own community, to take control of what we can in order to do some things that might mitigate some future effects. These go by names like transition towns movements, or a lot of church activity is starting to spring up. But there are large and small and even individual, if you can call it an individual group, groups getting together saying, we need to know where we're going because the story, our dominant narrative, is not working anymore. Where the president comes out and says, we are going to return to economic growth, and we're going to get jobs back as fast as possible, and you know that story is an old story, and a lot of people have started to question that and said, I don't know if I want to put all my money on that pony. Maybe I'd like to have a little bit of my resources otherwise dedicated. So this vision, having a clear sense of where we're going and how we're going to get there, is something that we desperately need to figure out together, and it's really the most important part of this. And I think once we've got that, many of the action solutions responses will start to fit in under that. But first, we have to have that piece. So what does that look like? Where do we want to be in 10 years, 20 years? I want to create a world worth inheriting. That's my highest vision. I love the quote that at the end of Dick's presentation. I truly believe that creating a world worth inheriting is my moral duty. And that happens to be what drives me. And I understand that that's mine and might not drive for everybody. But that vision is the part that is still lacking, and I think that's creating the uncertainty that I see in our country and the conversations I have with people. The anxiety is because the old story is breaking down a little, it isn't working, so where are we going? And this is the part where I would challenge that at the state level, here with the Energy Commission, elsewhere, that this is the part that's most needed, is really clearly articulating what do we have to do and how are we going to do it. So thank you.
Staff has collected some of the questions that have been submitted. If you have questions, make sure that someone is aware that you have them, and we will do our best to get through as many as possible. And Chris, I would like to thank you very much for an extremely stimulating presentation.
Thank you.
Of course, we knew it would be. Let me start with the inevitable. We have a couple of questions about nuclear energy, which are basically the same. Doesn't your presentation give a clear story why nuclear energy is needed over oil, over old oil and gas energy?
So why nuclear energy is needed? Well, there's two parts to this story. The United States happens to be past peak uranium mining. We hit that peak in 1980. It was a long time ago. And China right now has on the books 43, 45 nuclear plants that they're going to build between here and the next 30 years from now. And they've already got four under construction, and so they're racing along. Nuclear could be a big part of the story, but one of the elements of this that we have not yet answered is where's all the uranium going to come from? We are currently using uranium from decommissioned United States and particularly Soviet-era warheads and mixing that back down and using that for the fuel for our reactors at this point in time. We have not gone down the route yet of wanting to go into reprocessing or into even further down the line into fast breeder technology, which could be a way of reclaiming a lot of that spent fuel rod uranium and putting it back into circulation, because there are enormous challenges with that. Some of them are political. Some of them might be related to terrorism or other concerns. So the story of nuclear, I do believe it has a role to play, but probably not in the old style, which means that Westinghouse builds this huge, giant containment dome water reactor. There's some very interesting new technologies out there which have smaller plants with way fewer moving parts. Some of them are not much bigger than a couple of refrigerators put together. I'm seeing things develop there which are important parts of this story. The thing to keep in mind, though, is that that orange wedge that was on the amount of oil that we import, a couple things about it. First of all, nuclear energy creates electricity. It doesn't create liquid fuels unless we find some way to convert electricity into liquid fuels, which we could, but there'd be losses involved in that story. That orange wedge, though, just on an energy basis of the amount of oil that we imported, on an energy basis, comparing that to nuclear power, is the equivalent of standing up and operating 750 nuclear plants. So if we wanted to completely change, somehow magically, from running our society on oil and put it over into nuclear, we'd have to build 750 plants, which is fine, but there are only 440 plants operating in the whole world today, which means we'd almost double the existing supply. And nobody has any idea where that amount of uranium would come from unless we're willing to entertain the idea of building fast breeder technology, which is one possible avenue down that. So it's not to say it won't play a role in this, but to think that we will seamlessly just transition from oil energy into nuclear energy without a lot of thinking around a huge amount of resources allocated, without additional risks that need to be taken, is really a story that needs to be, I think, more fully appreciated.
Considering the mathematical dependencies of ratio, that is energy out versus energy in, and depletion and demand, is the price of oil about to go to $1,000 a barrel, or will the price sensitivity be sufficient to allow a gradual rise? Or, in parentheses, will we have another war?
Well, predictions are really difficult to make, especially about the future. That's Yogi Berra, by the way, so that's not me. One thing that we've seen is that oil hit 147 a barrel, and that was probably one of the triggers, one of the pins that pricked the expansion that we were enjoying up to that moment in time. So in my world, I believe that $147 a barrel oil was one of the reasons that we started our economic slump. Of course, having a big overhang of debt didn't help the situation. But we found that it was really kind of hard to operate our society at 147. So oil prices collapsed back, our economy collapsed back, and then we've now discovered that all new oil, like nobody now is going to drill for oil in the deep water unless it's at least $70 a barrel, guaranteed, maybe higher. That would just be the marginal cost to produce it. So we know that oil now has a floor on it. Like if it goes much below 70, we're not going to drill for it. Means that we won't have additional production, which means that we'll just have less and less and less energy. So oil's going to have to stay above 70 but below 147, right, apparently? And so we might think that the next thing that will happen is, well, our economy will recover and then oil might go up and run up to some other number that then becomes a new ceiling, causes our economy to drop. But the price of oil continues to rise in terms of what's required to extract it. Just think of it as kind of like there's a ceiling and a floor, and that ceiling and floor are going to start coming closer and closer and closer together. Because I don't think our economy could survive $1,000 barrel oil, even though it's worth it. It's worth every penny. Trust me, if you've ever dug a hole by hand and then brought in a backhoe, it's worth it. So I think oil price is absolutely, it's worth more, but whether our economy can function on more is a really open question. We hit that first boundary at 147. I don't know, I mean, on this next piece, if all of the charts and projections are right, one thing I know is that oil is really not a negotiable substance. Yes, oil demand went down this year. It was the first time it went down globally in the whole data series, and I think it's going to be down close to 1%, 1.5%, something like that. China's coming on like gangbusters. India's starting to use more and more. Countries that were exporting a lot are starting to consume it internally, so that would be Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela. They all have internal demand growing. So what we'll find going forward is that, yes, oil is worth a lot more. We'll find ways to pay for it. It's totally not a negotiable substance. But I think that what we're going to find is that collapsing sort of accordion if you might think of it that way, with a ceiling and the floor squeezing together. It means that we have less and less maneuvering room within those bands to make decisions. So, yes, I see higher oil prices in the future. No question about it. We'll pay it because we will need to do that. That's to qualify in current dollars. I'm not entirely clear on what a dollar is going to be worth in 5 years. Right? So it's possible we might have $1,000 a barrel oil in 5 years, but it might be in dollars that have very different meaning than today. So the number will be hard to compare. So in current dollars, I can absolutely see higher oil prices that we would pay because it's that important to us. So I think it would probably end up going there.
How about an easy one?
Sure.
How would you change our monetary system?
The first thing I would do, and I haven't figured out why this is not a possibility, is I would stop loaning money into existence. That's what I would do. I would clearly, there's no reason that we can't issue, money is just, it's a medium of exchange, it's something we use. It helps facilitate commerce, it's not a magical substance. So whether we loan it into existence or the Treasury just issued it straight out, kind of immaterial in some respects, but it's wholly important in another respect. And that is whether that money, once it's out in circulation, whether it has to be paid back with interest or not. That has an enormous set of implications. I might start, one of the things that I am starting to do in my local community, because this is something I can get my hands around, is to create different parallel currency systems so that should one fail or become unavailable, we'll have other ones in play ready to use. And this is an important point. Every money type enforces some behaviors and punishes others. A high-interest money system has been shown repeatedly through time to absolutely constrain and shrink people's time horizons. So if you're in a very high-interest money system, you will find that we build buildings a little bit shoddier, we pave roads a little bit thinner, all kinds of things happen. And on a zero-interest money system, you get much longer duration kinds of thinking that happen. All of the great cathedrals in England were created at a time when they had been suffering an enormous amount of deflation because they'd just gone through the bubonic plague, they'd lost 25% of the population, and they had money in circulation that was in circulation essentially at 0% because the problem wasn't money, it was shortage of labor. And once, isn't this amazing? They had a shortage of labor, and all of a sudden money goes to zero, and the first thing they think of is, hey, let's build something really big that'll last 1,000 years. It's a really strange thought, but we see this time and time again. So the question is, we have a money system, and that's wonderful. I would actually support having multiple money systems, not just one, all operating in parallel. I would love for the Federal Reserve notes to have competition so that I, as a consumer, could decide, would I rather hold these or those? I could make my choice at the bank. Which would I rather take? And that way, I think it would, you know, competition, if competition is good for business, and if it's good in schools, and if it's sort of, least, you know, embedded in our culture, why do we not have competition in our money system? Because competition forces people to react and respond and, you know, operate in ways that they otherwise wouldn't. So one thing I would do is I would open it up as a starting point. And there are a number of models out there for how this can work. All those can be investigated.
Please discuss some examples of economic growth with less energy use, more productivity, more efficiency, figuring out how to create things with renewable and or reused resources.
I've been a big fan of watching what's been going on in the permaculture movement. Has anybody heard of that before? Oh, yeah, lots of people. So it's basically it's a principle of farming, of dealing with the natural world, which has enshrined within it a couple of core principles. One of them, which I love, is do the least amount of work possible. The second is that the problem always contains the solution. Permaculture is more to me a way of thinking than it is a set of tasks that you do around your garden. And the way of thinking goes like this. It says that if we really burrow in and try and understand what the system is that we're trying to fix, we can find ways, for instance, to have economic growth. What's economic growth? Economic growth is where we take something, some raw good, and then we produce it and turn it, transform it in some way. And that raw good could be copper ore, or that could be our skill sets. It doesn't matter. But the idea here would be that we need to start finding ways of doing more with less. And any way that we can start to find to do more with less is something that really absolutely I would support. And permaculture has just been a master at sort of teaching me ways to do more with less. So here's a really silly example, but I think this works. So I just put in an orchard in our property, a small one, like 25 trees, and we put a fence around it to keep the deer out. And then I was scratching my head because now I have to mow around a whole bunch of trees inside of a fence. You know, and this didn't appeal to me. And this young kid up the street who's into permaculture, he's just wonderful, real bright, shiny guy. He came up and he looked at it and he said, well, you have chickens and you've got a fence, so why don't you just put the chickens in there? They'll turn this all to dirt, and then we'll plant clover in there, which doesn't grow high enough to mow, and it fixes nitrogen, which your trees are going to love. It's like, ooh. Right? It's a silly example, but not really. It says that in the old, you know, my old way of thinking was, I have to find a way to mow this now, and in a new way of thinking, it's saying, we just have to start doing things a little bit differently. And that roughly represents, it's a story to me about economic growth, because now I'm going to have higher output, higher productivity with less inputs. I'm going to be doing more with less because of that creative way of thinking through the solution. And so I truly believe that we can have sustainable economies, but we're going to have to fundamentally understand that the old way of taking more and more resources and siphoning them through and then excreting the waste out the back end as if it was useless, those days are going to be pinching down and drawing to a close. And so the real challenge is, how do we pull stuff in and make the most of it and really circle stuff back around over and over again? And so, you know, we've got another example. We have a biomass plant that is being proposed for our community of Greenfield. 47 megawatts, they're going to need, like, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of acres of forest land to make it run. And then they need wastewater from their wastewater treatment plant to cool it, because all of this. And my main complaint that I've written in about is that if we are treating waste, heat is a waste substance right now, this is a bad idea. Because there are ways to use heat as a valuable input to all kinds of things. In fact, cogeneration plants have been running for decades, which use both the electrical output from burning biomass and the heat that comes out to heat and cool. So the old way, we could, you know, we build a big plant, it's 47 megawatts, and heat is this giant waste product we have to get rid of at enormous cost. That's the old way. The new way is, I think we can still have that use of that biomass, but we're going to have to think about all the things coming in. How did you put it? To get the squeal out of the pig? Was that it? Right? We're going to have to be more like that. And that, to me, is economic growth, and it's economic transformation.
Can you address the relative value between energy return and economic return? For example, ethanol may have a low energy return, but how does that balance with its economic return? Does energy equal economic return?
No, they often are very, very different things. So we do things for economic reasons right now. The problem is that we don't often get, or sometimes do not get, accurate information from our prices. So if something is subsidized, by definition, you have inaccurate information coming from the prices that result from that. And ethanol being heavily subsidized, I'm not sure it's giving us correct information from the energy standpoint. Economically, because it's subsidized, it has a whole story that probably hangs together quite beautifully. But from the energy side, that story doesn't quite fit together. And what we're going to discover as we go forward is that the economic story is just one leg of the stool. Another really important one is the energy part, and we're going to have to get both of those parts right. And eventually they'll converge. Eventually we'll figure out that the energy story is the one that actually drives the story. That if we find ways of having high net energy return investments, we have two investment possibilities. One has high net energy, one has lower net energy. But this one's more economically compelling for whatever sets of reasons. We will find long term that these were the right ones to do. Because high net energy is really the stuff that drives our society. That's the stuff that people can, who knows what, figure out to do all kinds of things. So in my world, it's the net energy is the one that we really need to have our eye on as the first order approximation. That should be the thing by which I would sort all sorts of projects with and look them, you know, square up and down and say we're going to pursue those with either the highest potential to return high net energy or the actual returns that we know them today. And next, we'll start to feed in the economic pieces and the dollar costs around that. That would be my personal filtering system to go through those projects. And I think we'll get there eventually, but they are, at this point, separate concepts.
I'm convinced and agree that awareness and understanding are absolutely critical to leading to a solution. But there are people who have heard, actually the writer said in this room, who have heard the urgency and the story yet remain in politically supported denial. How do we accelerate the understanding?
Accelerate the understanding. That's a good question. You know, 3 years ago, I thought I was in the business of sharing information. And then I had one of those blinding insight moments, and I realized I wasn't. I just shared a bunch of information with you, but it was different. I started to become more effective when I realized that I was actually challenging beliefs. Beliefs about money, beliefs about how the future was going to turn out, beliefs about authority, religion, even technology, big one. So understanding that this in this story, we're not really just sharing information, we're actually challenging beliefs, that's tricky work, always has been. And I've since learned that there are two ways that people change. One is through pain. Right? You have a heart attack and all of a sudden you change your eating habits or exercise or some other event causes you to change. That's one way people change. And the other is through insight. Insight that could be garnered through experience or through a bunch of information like this or through other channels. Those are the two prime ways. And so one of the ways that I also became more effective in telling this story was completely dropping and losing connection with any sort of attachment I might have to whether or not you believe me or follow through. For a while, I really cared. You can ask my wife. Like, you got to listen. You know, I went through this whole period. Right? Wasn't that effective?
Doesn't work with the legislature either.
Right? And so now I have my position is listen. I'm really glad you listened. It's up to you whether you do anything with this going forward or not. And that's as far as I'm going to go with it. Because I know that everybody will get to this story when they can. There's a lot of reasons why people are at different stages of this story. I don't really like the word denial because it implies something active. Often denial, as we might call it, or has very valid real reasons for existing in somebody's life. I was told by a single mother at one point who came up, you know, after a seminar, and she'd left early on. She said, I can't listen to this now in my life. So that's fine. I completely understand. So part one of this is if you really want to start to get effective with this, is to understand where people are in the story. And by the way, people go through very predictable stages with this. When I was out in Sonora, California, they'd gotten in a town of 20,000, they got over 440 people to cram into an opera hall to hear me talk. Basically give this talk. And what was so fun was the guy who brought me out, this guy Coop, who's an architect, really well connected in town, just admired, wonderful business he ran. He was inviting me to meet with people beforehand, and he would bring people up and he'd go, oh, this is Bob. He just watched your crash course 2 weeks ago. He's in stage one, so go easy on him. You know? And they had this whole thing worked out where they understood that people would go through stages with this stuff. And they held that. They had a container for that, in essence, because they said, listen, I went through stage one and then stage two, and I'm in stage three. So they had it all sort of mapped out that there was a progression people go through. And so the other thing I would invite you to do if you're talking with somebody who won't get it is to understand that you are where you are with the material after however much time you've taken to get there, and that you're probably going to change from where you are, too, at some point. And it's okay. Wherever people are is okay. And as soon as you can have compassion for that and say, wherever you are is fine, a lot will get a lot easier, and you will actually be more effective. So that's something I've certainly learned through time, and it took me a while to get there.
There have been a number of questions regarding population, and I think this was sort of the most comprehensive. How does all of this interact with population? Not just increased or decreased, but demographic transitions as well. By which I think is meant, you know, at least in this country, I don't know what the situation is globally, that we do have an aging population, mm-hmm. relatively speaking.
Well, we have a demographically speaking, we have a bulge. And that is rapidly being corrected as well. So 2007, the most recent data we have, the United States recorded the highest number of births that it had ever recorded. in its history, far surpassing, or at least surpassing, the baby boom birth year, which was a peak. So yes, we have a demographic bulge which shapes a lot of what's about to happen in terms of our entitlement programs, has a lot of implications therein. But that's sort of a local story that's going to play out over a period of time. The larger story is we know that someday, like any organism, humans are going to come into balance with their ecosystem, which for us is the whole planet, sooner or later. I mean, unless we want to be like reindeer on the island in St. George, which, exploded in population, ate all the lichen, and then crashed. If we want to avoid that, we're going to have to find a way to navigate towards a stable population that is in balance with what we know we can sustainably use. And by sustainably use, that to me doesn't mean maximizing the number of people we can cram into every square inch. It means leaving enough space for other animals, other organisms, so that ecosystems can be intact, so that we can live high-quality lives within the boundaries of those ecosystems. So we know we're getting there. We just don't know when or how, right? And we don't actually know the parameters of that story yet because of the degree to which our existence has been subsidized, there's that word again, by the use of oil inputs into our food production system. There's an enormous amount of embodied energy in every calorie that we eat. Some estimates go as high as 10 or even 15, but we'll stick with 10, that there are 10 calories of oil energy embodied in every calorie that we eat. So there's a huge transition we're going to have to manage, and we honestly don't know what farming without petrochemical inputs looks like at this point in time. We don't really have good models for that. So you ask again about what kinds of things can, should we start doing that are non-status quo. I'll turn to permaculture again. I can't even imagine what permaculture as a movement could do with $5 billion. They're probably operating on 50 bucks, right? Or I've seen this incredible work that Wes Jackson is doing in terms of prairie soils and recreating soil structure in depth. Or it said there's incredible work being done out there, but again, all on marginally relatively shoestring budgets. And so if we want to, and this is my highest hope, is that we successfully and gracefully navigate our way towards this new future where we're living more in balance and that we don't just overshoot and crash. I really don't want to do that, right? And I don't want my children to have to go through that, and I don't want anybody to have to go through that. And guess what? We don't have to. But I think we're going to have to start recognizing where the water is on the stairs and start getting a little bit more serious about treating soil as if it mattered, because it does, right? Or treating water as if it mattered, because it does. These are all things that I think are pieces that we need to start shifting our thinking around. And so in the larger scale, I have no clue what to do about world population. I just know that that we are going to globally have to at some point find a way of navigating into a sustainable population. We don't know what those numbers are yet. We just don't know. But there are concerns that our current trajectory is going to take us to 9, 9.5, maybe even 10 billion, just under current operating assumptions about longevity, about fertility, and how many people are on the planet right now. That's where the UN calculates it all and says 9.5 billion, roughly, right? So we know we're going up to there, but the question is, where should that number be? Can we hold it there? Can we go to 12? Does it need to be 3? We don't know the answers to that yet. So again, this is something I think we have to really start thinking about outside of how we used to be thinking about it.
Could you discuss the relationship between growth in the money supply and periods of war?
Well, in any war, it turns out that governments have two choices. One is to tax the people to pay for the war, and the second is to print money. There's no war in existence that I know about in our country's history where the tax people decision was made. So in the Revolutionary War, we printed something called scrip, continental scrip, experienced massive inflation because we printed far more of it than there was goods and services. We were on a gold money system, so eventually all the scrip went away and the gold money came back out of hiding and inflation went back down again. And that happened again in 1812, and it happened again in the Civil War, and it happened again in World War I, and it happened again in World War II. And it's happening again now. Afghanistan and Iraq wars have both been paid for with accumulations of debt, which is the equivalent of printing. The difference between printing up a continental scrip and dumping it into your economy and ruining people's purchasing power immediately is that when you take debt and dump that into the economy, what you do is you ruin future generations' prosperity. There's a time lag on it. So it's a slightly different mechanism, but it's actually the same mechanism when you boil it down. So it turns out that whether it's war or whether it's anything else, making hard, difficult choices about spending, if those decisions always end up defaulting into the equivalent of printing, then we'll find that we'll run through the same story as it's been written dozens and dozens of times in the past. Great book if anybody wants to read it, written in 2008 by Kenneth Rogoff, a Harvard professor. It's called This Time is Different. It chronicles 60 different experiences where governments basically got themselves into debt situations currently approximate to ours and asked the question, what did they do? And starting in 1396, I think, was the first example in Hungary, on through to present, every single time the same set of decisions was made, the print. It's very easy to do, and it's very easy to understand why. It always seems like the right thing to do. It's always politically easier. Unfortunately, it's always ended the exact same way. And that's one of the chief concerns that I and some other observers have, is that nobody's compellingly explained why this time it's really going to be different. Like how it is that we can be assured that we've got better controls and a better way of dealing with all this money that's been unleashed than we have in times past. Maybe we do, but I think that we ought to at least allow a little bit of a possibility that if we have 60 examples where it always turned out the same way, that maybe this time it has a chance of turning out the same way. So that's been a concern of mine for a while.
Building wind and solar, and I might add other kinds of renewable energy infrastructure, will take a lot of energy. Will this be more energy than we have access to?
Yeah, so that's asking the energy question. So if we had to put some number of BTUs in to create a wind farm, you know, getting the steel, the fiberglass, the support columns, pouring the cement, getting the workers there, if we wanted to make this transition to a different sort of a future, do we have the energy left to do that? I don't think so. There's something embedded in that that I want to tease out. I don't think it's impossible at all for us, through any combination of alternative technologies that I've yet seen, to be able to seamlessly continue doing exactly what we've been doing with no changes. I haven't seen it. This is just on a BTU basis or a joule basis, however you want to measure energy, watts, I don't care. The idea that we've been consuming so many terawatts using fossil fuels, and now we're going to, you know, terawatts and alternative energy don't go together well yet. And not only do we need that amount of base capacity, but we need growth. We've been growing our energy use year over year, over decade, by some considerable percentage. And that's how our economy functions. And so the idea that we're going to seamlessly transition to alternative energy, seamlessly meaning everything just carries on as before, no hiccups, I can't buy that story yet because, you know, just even using a napkin and a pencil, I can figure out why that story has holes in it. Instead, I think what we need to be looking at is how are we going to do more with less? How are we going to conserve? How are we going to fundamentally use a lot less energy? I know we can do it. I have a good sense. So I was just over in Europe a while ago. It looked to me like they were leading perfectly normal lives that didn't seem too full of hardship to me. And they use half the energy we do per capita in this country. So my guess is we could probably make some reasonable adjustments just in terms of how much we use without a huge hit to our lifestyle. So if the question is there enough energy in the world to seamlessly transition into an alternative energy future without causing us to have to make any changes over here, my answer is a resounding no. Can't see it, as I currently understand it. But one of the great things about coming from a scientific background is that if the data changes, I'll change too. But right now, I don't see anything in the landscape that's been compellingly presented that says we're going to do that. So instead, we should be asking, what sorts of changes can we make, should we make, that will build resilience into our future, allow us to lead lives full of meaning and purpose with less energy as an input. And I think we can do it. Thanks.
Economists claim that innovation is the source of wealth. Please comment how this fits into your perspective.
The source of wealth. Let me talk about wealth for a second. So when we think of wealth, often we're thinking money, but money is an expression of wealth. Primary sources of wealth. You have primary wealth when you have rich soils, concentrated ores, a good, solid skill set. That's a primary source of wealth. It's stuff that you can transform. So we take the ore body and we do stuff to it, and now it's a rod of steel. That's a secondary source of wealth. So we transform the primary source to the secondary source. The tertiary source of wealth, which is all the abstractions we can layer on the secondary source. These are derivatives and paper products and bonds and stocks, all that stuff. Those are really only exist because the secondary source was there, and those only exist because the primary source was there. This is how wealth really comes through. Innovation is an important concept, and it helps in the transition between those pieces. So you can extract more wealth from your primary wealth and turn it into secondary wealth with innovation. But we should always, I think, endeavor not to lose sight of the fact that our primary source of wealth is clean water and rich, thick, productive soils and these rich ore bodies, which are now somewhat depleting. So I'm a huge fan of innovation. I really am. I like to put it in context. We've never gone through an innovation cycle where we suddenly are 100% more productive one year than the next. It's very incremental. It takes time to work through these processes. Any business, a large manufacturing concern, might be really impressed if it can improve its productivity by a few percent a year reliably. So, yes, those innovations and those pieces will come, and I'm a big fan of those, but I'm not thinking, I don't ever think that those sources of innovation are then going to somehow cover this gap that we see in the energy structure at this point. Again, if I could wave a magic policy wand, though, one thing I would do is I would find some really impressive-sized pool of federal money, which would be just a drop in the budget, maybe $1 billion that would be given out for a prize for somebody who could figure out a better battery or could figure out a better, you know, a way of manufacturing an electric car that could actually be mass-produced at scale or something. Because I really truly believe that people, we've got incredible minds and tinkerers out there. I'm a little disappointed that when I look at things like the next generation of batteries, I keep getting excited. I read all these tech journals where somebody's got this super energy density and it's a ceramic battery and it's awesome. Then you dig through and you find out it's a guy and he's got three people working for him and they've got a little bit of venture money. And it just seems woefully insufficient. It feels to me like that's something where we just ought to have, like, it should be measured in billions. It shouldn't be measured in venture millions. There's a world of difference between those two pieces. So if we could unleash our innovation, our productivity, and this is where the vision would come in. Where's the president? This one, next one, last one, who cares? Again, not partisan. Saying, what we need to do is we need our best and our brightest to be navigating us towards a more efficient, more productive future focused on energy. That's where we need our productive people to go. Here's a big pile of money, and I bet you magic would happen. I'm willing to try.
Kind of a related question to that. In economic growth theory, economists have estimated that technology has been responsible for the majority of economic growth over all of history. How does technology, the type explained in the first talk, I believe that refers to the IRI initiatives that Dick Hemmingson described, fit into this picture of depleting resources and increasing energy demand? Or I think, in other words, was Dick talking about a solution?
Mm-hmm. So I see this next period as it's a transition period. I don't at all think that we're going to face a hard stop, a collapse. These things are remotely possible, but I just don't personally put much stock in that type of thinking. I do believe that we've got a long transition period, and technology plays a role in that transition. Where I differ from traditional economists a lot is that traditional economics got its birth in the 1700s when some guy who was trying to finally put some math around economics, he went over to physics and he borrowed some equations, right? Found some journals and started to smash economics into these equations. Unfortunately, our understanding of physics at the time only got us to the first law of thermodynamics. We still didn't have the second one under control and didn't know about the third, but he went and borrowed some early stage physics. And the surprise in this story is that for 150 years, nothing changed in economics. And so finally, there was this wonderful story where at the time, the CEO of Citibank in the early 80s said, he fired his whole economics department. He said, this isn't working. You guys do predictions and it just doesn't help. But he thought that was unacceptable. So he put together something and put initial funding into something called the Santa Fe Institute, which was intent was to bring all of the world's best minds. So all these Nobel laureate scientists, physicists, chemists, economists, got them all together and said, we have to start thinking about things in fundamentally new ways. And so they all sat down from the table, across the table from each other, and when the economists explained what they did, there was a great quote. A physicist jumped up and said, oh my God, I feel like I'm on an archaeology expedition. You guys aren't using those equations, right? Because they'd been modeling economics as if it's a closed system, meaning that all you had to do was understand the parameters and it operated all by itself. And physics had learned a long time ago that most things are open systems, meaning that this only works if you're funneling energy in. And so a lot of economists don't even have energy on their radar screens. It's not part of their framework. It's not part of the thinking. It's not part of the math. And so it exists, and they do calculations around wonderful things like productivity and innovation and all of that, which is wonderful thinking. But without understanding how energy is that important input that creates the conditions that has to be constantly feeding through in order for this economic thing to work, is a deficit that needs to be remedied at this point. So I take enormous exception a lot of times with just pure economic thinking that is ignoring the other two E's, energy and the environment.
Well, you may have already answered this, but how do we make what you have just been talking about mainstream? Do we have to wait for a crisis?
Mainstream. Well, I'm trying. Myself and a lot of other people are trying, too. The thing that's been amazing to me is actually when I put the crash course together, I thought it was going to be a complete disaster. I mean, come on. It's 3.5 hours of material. There's charts. You know, it should have been a complete wreck. And put it out on the web, and it got 1.5 million views in its first year, and the views continue to be strong. So the interesting part of the story is that people out there are interested for rich context and information that's relevant and that actually seems to have some predictive power. And all of that, I think, is contained in being able to retell the story. But to really get this out and to be mainstream, I'm a big fan of a book Malcolm Gladwell wrote called Tipping Point. And it's just fabulous because the basis of the story of this is that marketers had been wondering, why did things happen? You know, like, why are these fads? Like, where do pet rocks come from? You know, but not other things. And in chasing it back, the story turns out to be pretty interesting, that social and cultural tipping points happen not because you got 51% or 82% of the people on board, but that you got the right 8 or maybe 9 or even 10% of the people on board. That there are people who are just off the charts intelligent connectors. They connect across groups seamlessly, or salespeople who can, not selling pens, I mean, they can communicate ideas in ways that people go, wow. And then you need mavens, people who collect information and can share that. But if you can get the right people, the people who have influence, is the way we talk about all three types, then you have a much better chance of creating that tipping point. And so that's what I'm working towards, is not trying to create a revolution, I'm just trying to create a tipping point of awareness. And I have a feeling in my own work that it's been increasing exponentially. Interest has gone up a lot. People are a lot more open to these ideas and receptive. And I have a sense that the way this is going to go is that someday we're going to wake up and it's just going to be self-evident and nobody's going to know why it happened. You know, why did the school of fish go left? We don't know, but we're all going left now. And that's where we are. So it really... You know, the other surprising part about the crash course is it got all those views, and I haven't spent a single dollar yet on advertising. It was all inbox to inbox. I guarantee if I tested your story about how you came across it for the people who watched it, you got it from somebody. And so that tells me that you know, that's what you need to start creating a tipping point is for people to carry it up and take it out and go for it. So I have created and produced the crash course into a 3-DVD set. You know, it's a set of discs that you can buy. And I did that because I found people were taking the crash course into their communities and then sitting people down for 3.5 hours, like, whoa, too much, you know. So I thought, let's break it up and allow people to take it into their communities and use it over the course of several weeks, because it's a lot of information. It has real implications, and people need to sleep on it. So we did that, and to my great surprise, you know, when I went out to Sonora, there was a guy who had taken that 3-disc set, opened up his office on a Thursday night, showed disc 1, then did the next Thursday, did disc two. Next Thursday, disc three. Fourth Thursday, they talked about it, and then he did it again. And he did that 6 months in a row. And by the time I'd gotten, his goal was, he said, I want to get to 3% of my town. You know, that I want 3% of my town to know about this. And so he's actually the furthest along of anybody I've seen of creating a tipping point. He did it by just being persistent and diligent and carrying it forward and being very non-confrontational about it and just letting people know he's always there to talk about it. So I've seen some models come up around that. And that's one way, and that's one tool. But there's an enormous awakening that's happening all across the net in all sorts of websites all over the place, and I consider myself just one node in that story. So to really get this to carry out, I think we've just got to be diligent, rigorous, and we have to be extra careful to be clean and careful and well-sourced and calm and rational in our approach. And you know, those are some of my sort of guiding principles on that. So we're getting there. I guarantee it.
This does get to a question. The energy curve for biomass energy is increasing rather than decreasing, like the oil energy curve. Plant genetics, agricultural practices, and processing technologies can replace a large share of petroleum. The greatest deterrent to building a biomass energy industry is a lack of investment capital. Do you agree?
Well, absolutely. We have not yet gotten serious about investing in alternative technologies in this country. I don't know what the last stimulus bill had, but it might have been $5 billion or something. That's not a serious amount of money, not even close. So if we were really serious about this, this would be the equivalent of a Manhattan Project times an Apollo Project times some large number, like 10. I mean, it's fairly serious. We have to change our energy infrastructure. I mean, one thing I know about is this idea of a smart grid. We have a fairly aged electrical grid in this country. A smart grid just makes sense to everybody who looks at it. Like, yep, that makes sense, right? It's going to require some amazing amount of money. Was it $40 billion, I think, to get it off the ground? Right? That's 1/8 of the amount that was dedicated to protecting Citibank's assets on one Saturday morning without any congressional oversight. So we're serious about Citibank. We're not serious about a smart grid. I mean, that's the only way I know to line those two elements up. I detect seriousness in what we do, not what we say. So we can talk about alternative energy all we want, but until we're really putting our money there, we're not serious about it. So, yes, I absolutely agree. We could have enormous impacts that would be wonderful to see. So here's an example, you know, to transition. We have, it turns out, a fairly significant amount of natural gas in this country, assuming we can solve the water quality issues with the fracking that goes on in the shale gases. But we have an enormous amount of natural gas. Would I feel differently if we were, as of today, converting cars to liquefied natural gas and had terminals where people could actually, fill up their cars? You bet. But we're not there. There's hardly any places that you can actually fill up an LNG car. And if you want to, as a fairly simple conversion process, but if you want to get a license to convert a car to LNG as a mechanic, it costs you $10,000. To get that license. And it has to be renewed yearly. So we're pretty serious about using LNG in cars, just not the right direction. We're pretty serious about inhibiting that. That's what a $10,000 license says to me. So we're not there yet. So when I start adding all of this stuff up, I don't really see any detectable signs yet that where we are on these energy curves, as I see it, is where we are on a policy direction at the national level. And I think that's when I say people have started to retell the narrative in their own line. This is why you find communities starting to think about how they're going to manage through a difficult period, because they don't see an alignment yet between what they're detecting and what they're seeing come out of our highest levels yet. There's a big gap there. And I suggest it's probably wider today than it's been when I started on this whole piece, because the data is much more clear than it used to be. And we're trundling along the exact same path we were on. So things are getting wider, not closer yet. So, capital is going to make a huge difference. Maybe one more?
Yeah, and this might be a good one to end on. There have been some sort of personal financial advisor questions that I chose to ignore because that wasn't really where we were going here, but this is somewhat related. Can you please talk a little about your personal response to this situation?
Well, oh, yeah, first I ran around in a circle with my hair on fire. I've calmed down a lot since then. So this is important information. My original training was as a scientist. You know, who you are is often defined by what you did. Not just any scientist. I came out of the pathology department at Duke. Pathologists are notorious for dealing in gray areas. You know, everything's statistics and probability. My uncle smoked 4 packs a day for 40 years. Is he going to get lung cancer? Like, I don't know. Maybe. So I don't deal in black and whites, and it's never been my style to say, we're going this direction, so that's going to happen. Here's how I run my life. I think there's a 50% chance in the next 5 years that the United States will experience a sovereign debt crisis. What will that look like? That'll look like a failed treasury auction. Is that a bad thing? Yeah. $10 trillion a year currently is cycling through our treasury system. If that ever hiccups, the pieces would fly apart on that flywheel in directions you can't even begin to imagine. Well, how would you protect yourself around that possibility? You know what? I'm going to take some of my money out of the system, which that was part of my impetus to get into gold and silver. Gold and silver are the only two monetary assets I know of which you can hold in your hand which are not simultaneously somebody else's liability. Even a $100 bill, it says Federal Reserve note. A note is an obligation. It's an obligation of the central bank in our country. So even that is somebody else's obligation and liability. If they mismanage that liability, that $100 note could actually turn into nothing in terms of purchasing power. So once I had started to protect my own personal finance, I was like, okay, now what? And so then I did some things around just becoming more resilient. That's the catchword here. Instead of having all of my energy in my house come in through a magic hose that goes into an oil tank, I now have solar panels on my roof, and I have a wood stove, and I've done some other things so that if any one of those sources goes down, I'm more resilient. And once I got through those basic levels of preparation, I then realized I'm only as safe as my community or my neighborhood. And I've been really working out in outreach into my whole neighborhood, on my street, and other places to work with other people who are just sort of interested in these ideas. And turns out there's a lot of people interested in these ideas. And so I've made enormous changes. I quit my job. I was vice president of a company called SAIC before I came in contact with this info. Once I came in contact with it, I kind of lost the thread as to why it was important to do that job anymore, and so I stopped it. But there I was. I was 42 with 3 young children, and I trained all of my life to get to that position, and I jumped off. And guess what? I didn't die. We cut our standard of living way down. Huge house, small house. Big boat, twin engines, kayak, double paddle. I still mourn the boat, but that's another story. But we made all of these changes. Guess what? Didn't die. Actually, our standard of living went down. Our quality of life went up enormously. So I've discovered that it's entirely possible not only to make these changes, but to have the outcome feel better, look better, be better, and better for my whole family, better relationships, all of these things. So there's an enormous story here that really needs to be told, because we are being fed a story constantly in our lives through marketing, through all kinds of things. It's telling us that the way you're successful and happy is through the acquisition of stuff. And it's been a really successful job of marketing that. And I was a complete consumer of that for a long time. And I've started to wean myself off of that, right? And discovered that I can do that and nothing bad has happened. So that's all fine and good. So the changes involved quitting my job, moving to a whole different community and setting down roots there, making enormous physical changes in our property, which represent investments to me, completely taking control of my finances away from a broker who seemed incapable of understanding the things I was thinking about, and managing that myself, really stepping out of our comfort zone, me and my wife, in terms of reaching out and building deeper community beyond the usual stuff that you might get at a party. And so these were all things that we actively undertook, and it's been a great ride. My closing message on it, though, is it took us 5 or 6 years, and I feel like we're just on the path. We're not done. We're just sort of started in a different direction. So these things take time, and we still have the luxury of time today. The sun comes up, oil still flows through our pipelines and comes out the magic hoses into our cars, electricity's on, all kinds of things. These are all still there, and it's a gift. It's really a gift, because the most important thing that I can possibly give anybody is time. It's the only thing I know how to give that really has huge value. So you've now heard the story. You may be discounting it. You may have bought it. Either way, You have either some work to do if you've bought the story and you think there's more things you want to do, or you haven't bought the story, maybe you're going to investigate it more or forget about it for a while. All of that's fine, but you now have the opportunity to go out and make real changes in your lives and your communities based on this information. And so this story for me is not doom and gloom. It's about change. It's about options. It's about opportunities. People who see this story early enough are actually lucky. They have more options than people who discover this story through some other forced mechanism later on. I have pages and pages of testimonials of people who on my site who said, thank you so much, I've changed what I've done, and it feels good. And that feel-good part is that people's actions are lining up with what they think or know to be true about how the world works. And that alignment, that's where the relief comes. Living out of alignment, that's where the anxiety comes from. The relief comes from lining up your own life and your actions with what you know to be true. So I know this to be true. I've lined my life up with it. My standard of living's gone up. I feel better. I sleep good. And I just want to bring that message to you and say, you can do it too. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you. All right.
Chris, one final, brief and practical question. May we download your PowerPoint explaining the crash course and show it to as many people as possible?
You certainly can. If I haven't put this exact presentation up anywhere yet. It's roughly contained in something called a 45-minute video, which is on my site. I sort of gave a talk like this in Boulder, but this one was way better. But I could put these slides up. But this exact presentation, I'm going out and talking at Yahoo headquarters tomorrow, and they're filming it. And if that comes out good, or if this version came out good, I'm going to put one of those versions up on the website so you could direct people to either this exact talk or one that looks a lot like it very shortly. But otherwise, the crash course is available for free to watch online. You can get discs for relatively cheap off the site if you know somebody who doesn't like to watch stuff on computers, prefers TVs. What else we got? Yes, we can help.
And if he's still here, Jack Rosbeck is somewhere here, who has some copies that he's willing to give to interested parties if they want to catch up with him. Thank you very much for your attendance and attention. And with that, this meeting is adjourned. Chris, thank you so much.